Okay, everyone, thank you for joining Thursday night class. Tonight we have a special dedication. It was dedicated by Lior Morgenstern. Remember Lior? She used to come here Thursday night, right? So now she's turning over the world in New York. She brought 300 people to the oil just yesterday. That event you saw on COL about people coming to daven for the hostages, that was her work. Lior, she comes here. She's great. Anyway, she sponsored today's class. She's probably listening now, so I'm not going to talk too much about her. Anyway, she's good. She's a powerhouse. So she sponsored tonight's event, and this is in honor of Hashem should protect all the soldiers. Amen. And her brother, special request for the protection of her brother, Yonatan ben Orit. May he be protected and safe and watched over. He and all his colleagues and friends out there in Gaza fulfilling the mitzvah of eradicating Amalek, which is truly Hashem's job. So if these guys are doing it on God's behalf, they better be protected. And also, it should be l'schos refu shalema for Malka Bas Mindel. And it should also be for the schos of all the hostages coming home. Amen v'amen. Okay, now that we've done that, we can put this away. Macha connection. Okay. And now we are ready to go. So we are in the middle of the class that we started last week, which was an explanation on the discourse we've been learning for three classes before that on Thursday night. So this will be familiar for those who were not here last week, but I don't know if you got a chance to listen online. In any case, the class that's called The Leap of Love, which is referring to the tremendous leap that God makes in order for his love for us. And the love expresses itself during when we study Torah. Because when we study Torah, we are able to connect to the truth of God, the truth of the Ein Sof, comes down to merge with us and reveal himself within us, although based on the way things really are, what happens when we study Torah is impossible, because creation, as we discussed earlier, all of creation, from the highest to the lowest. And we know there is multitudes and multitudes and multitudes and multitudes and multitudes on without an end of worlds stacked higher one on top of each other, meaning spiritually one on top of each other. And this goes on boundlessly and endlessly. And each world so much greater than the world before, and higher and loftier and loftier and loftier. But yet, all of them don't even contain within themselves one crumb of God's truth. Because he does not create them through an evolution, like we learned earlier, through him evolving into them, but rather he creates them yesh me'ayin, something from nothing. Which means the creator doesn't lean into the creation, he's creating them. The substance of who he is transcends them infinitely. Lean in, he doesn't like flow into them. He's above them and infinitely beyond. And although there is some godliness that does go into them and become part of who the creation is, all the way down to time and space. So there is somewhat of the divine that actually is contained within the world. In the words of the Hasidic terminology called the Mamalik Alamin, the indwelling light of God. However, that is not the substance of him. In terms of the substance of who he really is, even one cell of him does not come into the entire cosmic order. I'm using the term of a cell, that just we understand a tiny little something. Even one little atom of him does not come into the world. A ray, an external illumination, or as he also uses the term, his name, which is referred to his kingship, that does assimilate into the creation. But that is nothing. That is absolutely zero. And therefore, to God, all of creation amounts to absolutely nothing. From his truth. From his true transcendence. Zero, not a little small thing, literally nothing. And yet to that nothing, he wants to have a relationship. So when we meditate, when we comprehend and understand the nothingness of all of creation, that can be a very depressing thought. Because we're really, 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 really caught up in a non-entity. But the excitement is that there is a way to bridge. There is a way to break out of the created order and establish a communication and a connection with the infinite, who with the true being, with God's true being, who is infinitely beyond all the worlds. And how is that? And that's because of God's love. He chose to, his love of Israel, his love of the Jewish people, and through the Jewish people to the rest of the world, but to the Jewish people and to Israel and to the souls of Israel, God says, I will jump over the boundless or infinite chasm that exists between me and the world, and I will communicate my true self, invest myself truly into the nothingness of creation. And that's what we say when it says, when in the Song of Songs we speak about the bride, the whole Song of Songs, Shir HaShirim, is a song where King Solomon depicts the love that there is between God and Israel, between, and it's all it's all in a metaphor of a man and a woman that are in love with each other. So she is saying, and she is the us, she is saying, behold, my beloved is coming, he's leaping over mountains. So the significance of the leap, like we discussed last week, the leap is like when a person walks, you always keep one foot on the ground. The leap is that you, when you're leaping, you lift both feet off the ground. And there is now a true separation between you and the earth. God leaping is this, is that there is an absolute space between creation and him. So the leap in this sense first means a disconnect, an absolute disconnect. Had the world been created in a level of him flowing, he extends himself and flows into the creation through a chain-like progression of evolution, then it wouldn't be a leap. It would be like there would be always a continuum, a connection between him and the world. But because there is this infinite gap, that's why there is a true space and an unbridgeable space. We definitely cannot bridge that space because it's outside of us completely. We're absolutely outside of us. But God leaps over that space. And that's what happened when he came and he gave us the Torah. He leaped over that space. Now, where is he leaping to? He leaps to the universe. He leaps to the first vessel of the universe. What's the first vessel of the universe? The first container. He makes contact with the first container. And when we say makes contact, meaning he actually invests who he really is through in the Torah. He's really transmitting his true self. First, in where? In Chachma, in wisdom. Wisdom is the first of the 10 Sefirot. So God invests himself in Chachma, and that's where the magic of Torah happens. Torah is God's wisdom. But it's not the wisdom of creation. The wisdom of the creation means that the Creator left his true self behind when he emanated the creations. So the creation, the wisdom of creation is the wisdom of the ray of God, not God himself. The wisdom of the Torah is the wisdom of God himself. Now God is infinitely beyond wisdom, but the Hashem lowers himself down, the Ein Sof, into wisdom. And that becomes his inner wisdom. The wisdom that's not just the wisdom, it's not just the concepts, although the concepts themselves are obviously infinitely spectacular, but it's not that. It's that he is in those ideas. His true self is in those ideas, the ideas of the Torah. But obviously on the level of, and that's where the magic of Torah happens, we're on the first sefira of the highest world. The world of Atzilus, which, as we learned last week, is already part of the Mamalakal element. Remember, we learned last week, Atzilus is part of the worlds. From Atzilus and onward, including all the Sefirot of Atzilus, there is already an evolution of worlds. There's some kind of a connection. That's part of the nothingness. Atzilus is really part of the nothingness. And above Atzilus is where you have the infinite gap. And that's where God leaps over that gap from a beyond Atzilus, from his into Atzilus. But even after God leaps from beyond Atzilus, into where? Into the Chachma, into the wisdom of Atzilus. And it becomes, the Or Ein Sof kind of emanates and shines into the wisdom of Atzilus. And therefore, there is the Torah containing his very self. Like we say that the first word of the Torah is Anochi, which Anochi means Ana Nafshi, stands for, the word Anochi is an acronym for the word Ana Nafshi Ketavis Yahavis, I, my soul, God is saying about his very self, Kesavis, I inscribed myself, Yahavis, I transmitted myself. So God says, I transmit myself into the Torah. I compress my entire self into the Torah. But at this level, the Torah is not chewable, digestible, conceivable, knowable by any creation. It's utterly divine, because Atzilus is still a divine realm. It's the first of the worlds, but it's utterly a divine realm. So what we are going to learn now is once the Torah manifests or attaches itself into the seed of wisdom in Atzilus, then the Torah descends and opens itself up into the creations as well. The Torah itself lowers itself down and opens itself up into the creations. And that starts becoming the whole evolution of Torah, as the Torah opens itself up. This concept of evolution of Torah, we can see it in Torah itself. I mean, we can see it in the visible side of Torah. The godly evolution in Torah, where God comes from a sublime, unknowable wisdom, and descends more into a creation-like that creations can conceive and understand. You see that in the evolution of the way the Torah is physically, even the Torah that we have, we see this evolution. Because the Torah that we have begins with Scripture, and Scripture is very cryptic. Now, I'm not going to say it's completely incomprehensible, because you can learn Scripture, you can learn Chumash and Nach, and have somewhat of an understanding, but you sense that you don't get it. We sense that it's, especially without any commentary of the sages, it's a closed book, it's a mystery. When we say that God first emanates in Chachma, over there, even the Chumash, even the Torah, even Scripture, is not the way we read it down here. It's the way it is seen in God. I don't know what it means over there, Bereshis, how you read these words, Bereshis, Bara Elokim. It's the same words, but obviously with the infinite bright light of the divine. So we have no concept. But even when the Torah comes down into a readable, legible document that we can read down here with physical letters and physical and a physical story, you can still sense its divine nature. And you can sense its aloofness. It's still a closed book. Then the Torah starts to open itself up by the Torah flowing into from the written law, it flows into the oral law, into Torah Shebal Peh. When it flows into Torah Shebal Peh, it starts becoming far more a conceivable, understandable science, logic, discipline, into which we're being taught how to live our lives. So the Torah is addressing our reality. But even though it's addressing our reality so that we can fill every fiber of our being with the Torah, and also so that we should really be able to understand it, we have to realize that it's only an allegory, it's only a metaphor, it's a mashal for it's a mashal, meaning a metaphor for something infinitely beyond, incomprehensible and unknowable. So even when, as we study a law in Torah, now we're learning Rambam. The Rambam that we're learning now is dealing with the laws of loans and how when someone whips out a shtar, a contract, an IOU note. When someone pulls out a document that someone owes them money, when is that document valid? When is that document not valid? When does it carry? It's all these laws, and they're very logical. And they make a lot of sense. If the person, for example, we're learning the law, if the person who pulls out the document, which has signatures, and let's say the signatures were verified by the court, it's called kuyim, they endorsed it, it's all good. It's a powerful document. Yet the guy is a smart aleck, the one who's being the borrower, says, I paid that. And the guy admits and he says, yeah, you paid it, but this is a document for a different loan. So he already disqualified that document. Because once he pulled out a document for this loan, and then he's already saying, no, you're right, this loan is paid, but you owe me the same amount of money in another loan. It's like he disqualified. Like, it goes through all these laws. And complicated, back and forth, and he can spin it on him, and he can spin it on him, and it really makes you meshuggah unless you really have the patience to really sit and work it out. But these are, laws that are very logical and make sense, and so that's how we study the Torah. But really, these are infinite concepts relating to God's infinite reality and truth, utterly beyond. It contains the deepest mysteries of existence. And even that, the wisdom of it, the real gem, the real preciousness of it, is not even its wisdom. It's the essence of God who is contained in that wisdom. Because the wisdom is only a vessel, is only a container for something that's infinitely beyond the wisdom. And when you're learning the Torah, that's when this incredible union is taking place. That's when we can satiate our desire and our want to be unified with God. That's it. So our most fortunate moments in our lives is the moments of Torah study. We most of the time don't realize how fortunate it is. We're just learning because we have obligations to learn, because we took upon ourselves to learn, because the Torah says we should spend every minute studying, so we're not supposed to waste time and always study. So sometimes it feels like a burden, and it gets frustrating. But really, I mean, if you learn well, you're always enjoying it. But that's the what's really going on is what we're learning over here. It's incredible. It's spectacular. It's incomprehensibly spectacular. At this moment, the Soviv Kalam, the infinite transcendental truth, infinity of God, is converging with the finite worlds. He calls it the yichud, the unification of the sovev, the infinite higher light. It unifies with the mamale, with the sphirot, with the constricted and limited lights. Hashem and His name are becoming unified. Hashem and His shechina are becoming one, and we tiny little peep-squeak nobodies are actually part of this experience. We're first of all the ones generating it, we're causing it, and secondly, we're experiencing it in our souls. This unification is taking place. We're actually tapping at this moment something real. And as we learned at great length in the original mimer, that this is a commentary on it, that when you're studying, and he's going to make reference to it in today's learning as well, that when you're studying, It's really what is meant to be is meant to be a complete dissolving of ourselves into His truth. So much so that we're supposed to reach a point where we don't even hear ourselves. We hear God, thundering voice, the same voice at Sinai like we discussed, that doesn't stop. It's the same voice at Sinai that is just being tuned in and coming through our mouths as we are. And whose voice is that? That's the voice of the true being, of Hashem's infinity, of God's true self. And that's the meaning where he's going to explain. However, he's now going to show us how that manifests differently in the different parts of Torah. That in certain parts of Torah, when we study certain subjects of Torah, there is one aspect of the Ein Sof, and then in the other elements of Torah, there's another experience. And that's primarily what we're going to learn today. How, in general, in Torah, this connection is made. But in particular, it manifests in the various different parts of the... So here's important. The Soviv Kalalman energy is no different. Torah is Torah. It's God is invested in it. The question, however, is in which space of the Mamale Kalalman is it manifesting? Is it shining in is it the Orein Sof that is now bonding with the brain of God, with the mind, with the Chabad? Is it bonding with the heart of God? Or is it bonding, or is it as it's flowing in the feet, in the legs? Obviously, the light that shines in the head is the brightest light. The light, when it comes down into the emotions, is already a mitigated light. And the light that comes down into the feet is even more reduced, because the nature of the vessels, then they have a weaker capacity, a much lesser capacity. And what we're but through and through, it's all Hashem. It's just that how much is it capable of being revealed in the vessels? How much is opening it up? How experiential is it? So that's the difference of the Mishnah, the Braisa, and the Talmud. That's what we're going to be learning over here. As it's opening itself up to us. Okay. In order for this Sovev light, for this incomprehensible, or Sovev means really the we're holding, on page 176. In Likutei Torah, let me just show for those who are following an easier copy. In Likutei Torah, first of all, it's on page 84 in Shir HaShirim. The Maimer is called Hine Inyan Medaleg Al Aharim. It's on page 84, the second column, by the beginning of the paragraph Vihine. Now, in this little copy that I made, but I didn't make it from here, I made it from a different book, which puts in the kudos, and it's easier to learn. So from here, it's on page 176. And the second column, Vihine. It's the middle of chapter 2. In order for the Sovev, for the encompassing light, to unify with the indwelling light. In other words, in order for the creations to get a little piece of God himself, who al yedei esek haTorah. This is accomplished through the study of Torah. Koil doidi, the voice of my beloved, hine zeba, behold, he's coming, which is a verse that says, and it speaks about, which is referring to Sinai. But as we are learning over here, Sinai was not a one-time event. Sinai is a continuous energy flow that every single one of us is able to tap into. Whenever we sit down by a book of Torah, open it up and study, we are activating Sinai. We are activating Sinai, Har Sinai. The revelations that happened then are reoccurring now. Kimas nisen malkasa. Because the Zohar says that the Mishnah, this is a statement of the Zohar, and the Zohar says that the Mishnah is the queen. Or actually, not the queen. The Mishnah is the king. The Mishnah is the king. That means, what is the Mishnah really? It's God talking. That's what the Mishnah is. God is, what is all of Mishnah? God is telling us his likes and his dislikes. He's sharing with us his personal self. What he approves of, what he doesn't approve of, what is nice to him, what is ugly to him. Because you see what's kosher, what's not kosher. What behaviors are appealing to him, what behaviors are not, what are forbidden, it's like the king. A king giving decrees, that's what it is. And And what the Zohar is saying is that the Mishnah is literally, in its truth, is God is talking. It's just that the human mouth is just a conduit, yeah, good word for conduit, or a microphone, to pick up the divine voice and to give it expression in the physical world. The rabbis are called kings, because the rabbis, they're not speaking their own thoughts. They're just trying to decipher the will of God. And when they were learning, the rabbis, they had no self at all. They were melted. Their entire egos were dissolved. And they were so aware of the absolute oneness and of God, that there was none other than Him. And they were probing the depth of God's will to the point that they melted out of existence. So it was just God speaking through their mouths. Okay. Kimasnisa Malkasa, because the Mishnah this week when I was giving the class, I got scared that it was too, I was seeing so much yellow that I got scared and I turned it down, and people complained, so I made it louder, but not loud enough. Okay. Now it's good. Okay. Kimasnisa Malkasa, because the Mishnah, that's the king. And when someone is studying Torah and they say pure, this is referring to, let's say, where the question is regarding someone coming into contact with a type of impurity. Let's say someone walks under the outside ledge of a house and there is a dead body in the house, a corpse in the house. So we know that if you're in the same under the same roof, with a corpse, the person becomes ritually impure. So then the Talmud, the Mishnah, has discussions in which cases it's considered being under the same roof, which cases it's not. So when it's impure, the Mishnah says impure, and when it's pure, the Mishnah says the rule is the person is pure. Tahar, the person did not contact any contamination. So he's pure. Or it might be certain leprosy. You come to the Kohen and you look at it. If it has two hairs in it, it turned white or so. And there's all these laws, complicated laws. When a white sign, a discoloring on the body, the person is impure, ritually impure, or ritually pure. These are all these questions. Or regarding, it can be regarding one of the Tumah of Nida. You know, when is the woman considered impure? When is she considered ritually pure? All these questions. So that's what the Mishnah talks about. But what he's saying is that when we're learning, this is a very important point over here, we have to realize that we're not quoting a law. While we're learning, it's God speaking through our mouth, and God is sharing His will, pure or impure. And as he brings, Ani Mishnah Hamedaberes Bepicha. I am the Mishnah that is speaking in through your mouth. When we learn Mishnah or we learn Rambam, it's for the same sake, or Shulchan Aruch. It's all the concept of Mishnah, right? And what is that? The Mishnah is speaking through our mouth. This concept that the Mishnah is speaking through our mouth happened by the Beit Yosef. When the Beit Yosef was once, the Beit Yosef, the author of the Shulchan Aruch, he was a rabbi who lived in Tzfat. In the 1500s, in the 1600s, I'm sorry, between 1500 and 1600, he lived in Tzfat, Rabbi Yosef Karo, and he was the one who authored the Shulchan Aruch, the code of Jewish law. And when he would study, one time he would have an angel learning with him, and when he was studying. The voice was coming out of his own mouth, and it said, I, the Mishnah, am speaking in you. And that was very important for anybody who studies Torah, but especially the person who's going to give us the law, that it wasn't Rabbi Yosef Karo selecting the law. It was the Mishnah speaking in him and through him. So when we have a Shulchan Aruch authored by Rabbi Yosef Karo, it's not really authored by Rabbi Yosef Karo, it's authored by God. Because Rabbi Yosef Karo melted when he studied Torah. He dissolved out of being a somebody. And he was just the voice of God in this world because he was an incredible tzaddik. And he actually felt this way. Now, see, by us, it's true whether we feel it or not, it's the reality. But obviously, the more a person is egoless, and the more a person in their entire life is not caught up in their I, in their self, but they're so conscious of God, so by them, to a much greater degree, when they're studying, even people around it can feel that it's not them, that there's a channeling taking place. And that was by the B'Syosef. But the Alter Rebbe is trying to share with us that even though the B'Syosef, it says so explicitly by the B'Syosef, the truth is it's by everybody that studies. And the revelation is shining all the way up. In other words, even though this is, we're soon going to see, it's the divine emotion that's expressing itself. Because the Mishnas, all the Mishnayot are the expression of God's emotions, as we're soon going to see. But what's really important over here is not the emotional element and not even the intellect. Because in the emotion, as we're soon going to see, in God's emotion, God's emotions are guided and fueled by God's intelligence. Every emotion has a reason that's causing the emotion, that's driving the taste or the distaste for something. There is a deep, divine, infinite reason behind it. Why this is kosher, that's not kosher. Now, when you're learning the Mishnah, we're going to see, the Mishnah is not telling you reasons. The Mishnah is always telling you the laws. This is a kosher sukkah, this is not a kosher sukkah. It's not giving you the reasons. If you want to know the reasons, you have to either study the Talmud, or you have to look at the commentaries on the Mishnah. The commentaries of the Mishnah, they study the Talmud, who explore the reasons of the Mishnah. But the Mishnah doesn't give you reasons. The Mishnah primarily is occupied with the will, which are the emotions of God. Yes, he likes, dislikes, his kindness, his severity, what wants to draw close to him, what he wants to push away, and so on and so forth. Now, inside every Mishnah, which is an expression of God's emotion, lies the divine intelligence, which is higher than the emotion. Okay? That's the intelligence. Now, why are we excited when we're learning Mishnayos? Is that we can connect to God's emotion? That of itself is exciting, but that's not it. Why? Because we discussed earlier that the entire infrastructure of Sefirot, of personality traits by God, is only part of his name. It's not him. He's infinitely beyond any description. So it's part of the evolution of worlds. So really, it's part of the nothingness. Because the ray that we're talking about earlier is really nothing compared to true existence. So the excitement over here is not that it's the emotion. The excitement over here is not even the intelligence that's in the emotion. The excitement over here is that God took a leap from infinitely beyond and jumped into his intelligence, and through his intelligence invests himself into his emotions. And when we're getting the emotion, when we're communicating and hearing God's expressing his love or his kindness, we're getting his very self in that communication. And we're unifying with it. And that's what he's saying over here. V'hagiluy, and the revelation, me'ir, is shining, me'or ein sof, from the or ein sof, from the infinite one, from the light which is ein sof, infinitely beyond creation, which what we mentioned earlier is called the soviv kalalman, the transcendental light. And where is it shining? B'mishnah, it's shining into the Mishnah. B'tadira, it's there always. What does that mean, it's always there? Whenever you tune into the Mishnah and you're studying a Mishnah, you're accessing the Or Ein Sof that is now vested in this Mishnah. It's there without an end. That's why the Mishnah is called the Queen. Because the Queen is the Queen. She is the recipient. She's the vessel for her husband all the time. It's not a one-time phenomenon. She's designated for him to be unified with her. So that's why the Zohar says, I'm sorry, the Midrash tells us. The verse that says there are 60 queens. So the Midrash tells us the 60 queens are who? Are the 60 tractates of Mishnah. They are the queens. What does that mean? The queen means she is the container for the king. She's the vessel for the king. So who's the king in this case? The Or Ein Sof is manifesting himself in the Mishnah. Now, he's going to give it now because this is the beer on the mimer, which means this is not the mimer itself. This is the explanation of the discourse. This is the commentary that the Alter Rebbe himself gave on the discourse. And remember, we taught this many times, the commentators that the Alter Rebbe explains, he's always giving the Kabbalistic ideas, infrastructure, that is the backbone of the Hasidus that he explained. The Hasidus is the pure godly concepts of it. Then there is Kabbalah. Kabbalah is the divine language. So the Alter Rebbe is now going to bring the Kabbalah for what he already taught earlier as the Hasidus. As we already explained, that Hasidus is not an explanation of Kabbalah. Kabbalah comes to explain Hasidus. So the Alter Rebbe is using, he's now going to give you the Kabbalistic formula. And he says like this. Mishnah, the Arizal, the Ari tells us, Arizal is a great Kabbalist, right? And he reveals to us that the six orders of the Mishnah are correspond to the six emotions of God while they are vested in the world of Yetzirah, which is the world of formation. Okay, let's get that again. The Mishnah. Where does the magic of the Mishnah happen? Where does this Mishnah take? Where is the Mishnah constructed? The rabbis came and brought us the Mishnah. We're living in the material world, but they're actually fetching the Mishnah from a higher realm. They're tuning into another reality, and from there they're bringing down the Mishnah. If they would be bringing down the Mishnah from this world, if the rabbis would be just concocting the Mishnah down here, it wouldn't be too interesting. I mean, it's interesting, but that's human knowledge. They're actually drawing something down from a higher world, from a complete different realm. From where? From the world of Yetzirah. That's where the Mishnah comes from. Now let's review this. We're living in the world of Asiyah, that's our material world. Then there is the world of Yetzirah, which is a much higher dimension of existence, world of angels. Above that is the world of Bria, which is the beginning of creation, a very subtle state of creation, the world of souls. And higher than that is the world of Atzilus, which is purely a divine world. Now, the Arizal now says seemingly something that needs a lot of clarification. He says the Mishnah is it's the spiritual light of the world of Yetzirah. Not just the spiritual light of the world of Yetzirah. It's the divine emotions, the sefirot of Yetzirah. Because let's understand something. In every world, there's two things. There is the world, and then there is the divine input into that world. The divine energy that creates that world. Which, as we discussed many times, is the concept of ten sefirot. Every world has ten sefirot. The ten sefirot is divine. In all worlds, the ten sefirot is divine. It's divinity, it's not the creation. From the sefirot, that world is created. So the Arizal tells us that the ten sefirot manifest in each world. So and within the ten sefirot, there are six of them. Chesed, the six emotions. The ten sefirot are comprised of intelligence and emotions. So God's ten sefirot, when they are manifesting in the world of Yetzirah, that's where the rabbis picked up the Mishnah. That's where the Mishnah gets formulated. And when they tell us the Mishnah down here, we are now tuning into these emotions as they're manifesting in the world of Yetzirah. Now that needs a little bit of, and that's why, wait, before we started breaking that down and try to unpack that, but that's what we'll explain why there are six orders of the Mishnah, because there are six sefirot. Six sefirot. Six emotions. Which would mean that every order of Mishnah is encompassing another one of God's emotions. So for instance, the first order of Mishnah called Zeroyim, all about our agriculture. First it starts with brachot, with blessings. And afterwards, it goes through all the mitzvot relating to farming and agriculture and all those. That's all related to God's. It's all the energy over there is God's kindness. Then Moed, the book of Moed, which is all the all the mitzvot related to specific times, like Shabbos and holidays and so forth, that has to do with the attribute of Gevura, of Hashem's Gevura, because time comes from Gevura. People that are very Gevura digger people, people that are very disciplined, people that have a very strong Gevura, are usually people who show up on time. People that are very chesedig, very flowing, they have a hard time with time. Because their nature is very, it's very hard for discipline. They don't get them. So Moed is God being set on time. And then Nashim is Teferis, the book of marriage, because Teferis is harmony and union, which is the book of marriage, talks about all the marital aspects. And so forth, you go through the six emotions, the six orders of the Mishnah. Each one is encapsulating a different one of God's six emotions. Now, why the world of Yetzirah? Why the world of Yetzirah? If anything, shouldn't the Mishnah be, if it's divine, shouldn't the Mishnah be the emotions of God from the 10th sefirot of Atzilus? Because Atzilus is the world of that's divine. Bria is already creation. Yetzirah is already creation. So why are we saying the Mishnah is from the created realm? Isn't the Mishnah from the divine realm? From Atzilus, which is divine. The answer is, of course it's from Atzilus. It's the divine emotions. It starts in Atzilus. God's emotions are formulated, if you might say, come into manifestation where God emanates himself as in a human form. Beyond Atzilus, there's no Sefirot. It's higher than Sefirot. God is beyond the human image. But in Atzilus, God emanates a certain psyche, a human psyche. And over there, there's intelligence and emotions. So what did we say earlier? The Torah is God descending into the realm of intelligence. And the Or Ein Sof comes into Chachma, into wisdom, which is intelligence. From the intelligence, he formulates emotions, just like us. When we have certain knowledge, we create our emotions, develop around our knowledge, around our understanding. So God's emotions evolve from God's intelligence. But this is all Atzilus. How did we suddenly land with the Mishnah in Yetzirah? The answer is, of course the Mishnah is Atzilus. All of Torah is Atzilus. But the Torah as it is in Atzilus is so infinite and so beyond, it's talking about things that, it's talking about God, it's talking about the infinite. There's no way it would be given to us as it is in Atzilus. It's not our language, it's a divine language. So what Hashem does when he gave us the Torah, he takes his emotions and his will with all of its nuances and he packages it in the subject matter of our realm, of our world. He applies it to the mini world. He brings it down like a person giving a metaphor and enclosing something in something else. God takes his infinite wisdom and his infinite emotions. So of course the essence of Mishnah is in Atzilus, but it's completely unknown. The Torah that we're studying, that's talking about realities that are somewhat conceivable in the human mind, that's because those sefirot of the emotions of Atzilus vest themselves in the world of Yetzirah. And in the world of Yetzirah, these emotions, now the rabbis were able to experience God's will and emotions as they are manifesting in Yetzirah and translate them and bring them down to us and give us the Mishnah. Okay? So, but now you're going to ask, okay, I understand we couldn't entertain God's emotions in Atzilus. But why couldn't we entertain his emotions in Bria? Why do we have to go to Yetzirah? Well, Bria is already creation. It's already finite. It has already... So we can say, well, it's still too far. Okay, that would be an easy cop-out. It's too far, fine. But There is more of an answer, and the idea is as follows: it's not that we don't engage the godliness of Bria. We do, but we don't do that when we study Mishnah. We do that when we study Talmud. In Gemara, which is a commentary on the Mishnah, by the way, we are actually engaging the godliness on a higher level when it is in the world of Bria, which is higher than the world of Yitzhak. In Mishnah, we're encountering and engaging and communicating with God's emotions as they are manifesting in the world of Yetzirah and not in Bria. Why? And the answer is because although in each world there are all 10 sefirot, nevertheless, each world is primarily a seat or a vessel for different sefirot. So for instance, what does that mean? The world of Bria is primarily a brainy world. The entire world of Bria is a place of immense understanding. It's a world built on intelligence. The currency in that world is intelligence. That's the energy. That's the commodity of that world. So therefore, why? Because God manifests his Chabad, his Chachma Bina, primarily his Bina. The power of Bina is the main force, life force of the world of Bria. And that's why the souls that live there are super intelligent beings. And their intelligence is the intelligence, divine intelligence. They know God and as much as a creation can know him. But their knowing is spectacular because it's a world of knowledge. Now, of course, in that world, there is also the emotions, but the emotions are secondary to the knowledge. The knowledge is the primary force in that world. The world of Yetzirah, however, is a world where God's emotions dominate. Although there is also an intelligence in that world, but the intelligence are far less pronounced in that world. The intelligence is pronounced in the higher world. In that world, what is primarily the force, the life force, the energy, the intensity of it, is it's a world created by God's emotions. And that's why the Mishnah, which is going to open us up to the emotional element of God, is going to be formulated not in Bria, but in the world of Yetzirah. Because Yetzirah is where the emotions are in full display. The emotions are in full manifestation, they're in full intensification, fully expressed. They're more subtle in the world of Bria, not that expressed because they're canceled by the intelligence. It's like when a person is deeply in the thought of something, they can't experience the excitement of it because they're too much in the concept of it. Usually when you go away from the concept of something, that's when the emotion will come out. You create space for the emotion. When you're too deeply lost in the concept of something, then you can't feel how you feel about it because there's no you. You're lost in the logic of it. But when you kind of... So in the world of Bria, the emotions are not that pronounced. So when we're learning Mishnah, what are we doing? We're allowing the six emotions of Yetzirah to be... We're tapping into the six emotions of God. And not just that, but when we're studying it, we're allowing those emotions to express themselves in our mouth. And then God is speaking, God's emotions are pouring out through our mouth, whichever Mishnah we're learning. But the main point over here is, it's not the emotion. It's the emotion that it contains within it, the intelligence, which the intelligence contains within it. It goes back to Chachma, which Chachma has the Or Ein Sof in it, the infinite light in it. And therefore, when we're learning it, it's God himself that is now manifesting in our physical bodies. So, the six direction. Now, the six emotions of God are also the source of the six directions of space. That's why the six emotions are also called the six directions. So the six directions are mekananin, they nest be Yetzirah in the world of Yetzirah, in the world of formation. Piskei Adinim, and what does the Mishnah give us? The Mishnah gives us set laws. Piskei Adinim, set laws, gives us a verdict. We present the case, and then the Mishnah comes and the Mishnah says, in such and such case, this shall be the verdict. Kosher or not kosher, guilty or innocent, right? Piskei Adinim and b'chinas midos de Yetzirah. They are the emotions of God as they are emanating in the world of Yetzirah. The hamidos and the midos, shishuk tzavos, the six emotions, meirim sham begiloi, are shining over there in a very revealed way, ubetadira, and constantly. Now, what is this emphasis that it's shining there in a revealed way and constant? The emphasis of that is because we're in contrast to what we're going to see now. We're going to see that there are two other Torah studies. In a sense, the most beautiful type of learning is to learn Mishnah. And when you're learning Mishnah, you're getting the best of both worlds. When you're learning Talmud, you're going, in a sense, we're going to see soon, you have an advantage in Talmud that you don't have in Mishnah. But you also have a very great disadvantage. When you're learning Braisa, not Mishnah, you have an advantage over Mishnah, as we're going to see soon. Another advantage over Mishnah. But you also have a very big disadvantage. A different type of disadvantage than you have in the Talmud. The beauty of the Mishnah is that the Mishnah has both advantages. In other words, it has qualities that are not in the others in the sense of the attachment to God, as we're going to see. Kiyadua, but we're going to get to that in a moment. The Mila, let's just say, what's the quality of Mishnah? Number one, God is revealed there. Number two, it's constant. Now, Kiyadua, as it is known, Shehizgalus Oirein Soif Bechachma. Now, the question is, how is it that the Ein Sof is shining in the Mishnah? What do we mean he's shining in the Mishnah? So he explains like this. The Ein Sof, as we said, is utterly unknowable to the worlds. He's infinitely beyond the worlds. He's infinitely transcending the worlds. When he chooses to land in the world, which means when he chooses to make that leap that we spoke about earlier and land somewhere, the recipient, the landing platform is only one, Chachma. Chachma is the only place that God feels comfortable landing in. Why does God feel comfortable landing in Chachma? It's like a bird. When a bird is soaring in the sky, has to find a good landing spot. Or a helicopter wants to find a platform where it can land. So what's the airport, so to speak, where God can come down and land? Only Chachma. Why? Because to receive God, to be able to receive God, God is and there's none but Him. His reality precludes all of existence. If you're receiving Him, which means you're taking Him in, it means you have to acknowledge who He is. Who is He? He is and there's none but Him. So Chachma is the only one who has no problem melting out of existence completely. Chachma is the epitome of humility. Chachma stands for koach ma. Chachma is the vessel. It's on the one hand, it's a vessel. But on the other hand, what's its vessel? What is the vessel? Its vessel is that it can receive being not completely. It has the ability to receive and accept God for who God really is. Chachma, all the other sefirot, even the sefirot and the attributes and the worlds, maintain a little bit of self. Because they maintain a little bit of self, God is not comfortable in revealing Himself in them. That's it, comfortable. Their very self that they're maintaining is contradicting His truth. I'm trying to find a good example in the It's like when someone wants to have you over, but the condition they need in order to have you over is opposite of who you are. You can't have you over. I'm not pulling the right mushel now, but that's the idea. You can't have God over and not be willing to acknowledge who God is. He is, and there's none but him. He is reality. What do you mean having him over? His truth is revealing. What's his truth? That he is the substance of all reality. He is. So if you have to be willing to accept that. That's why, where does God dwell in Chachma? Now, Torah is what? Wisdom. It's God's wisdom. So therefore, God can dwell in the Torah. But when we say Torah, we mean the Torah in its pristine, original, divine form. It's the supernal Chachma above. Okay? Ki yadua shezgalus orein sof b'chachma. The orein sof reveals itself only in Chachma and the Torah. The oiraisa machachma nafkis. The Torah originates and no. The Chachma emerges, I'm sorry, the Torah emerges from Chachma, from the divine wisdom. V'chol adinim, now, but you say, behold it. When we're learning a Mishnah, the Mishnah are God's emotions, not God's Chachma. Yes, but what created these emotions? How are these emotions developed in God based on God's wisdom in which he himself is manifesting himself? The chol adinim kosher umutter, and all the laws of the Mishnah, kosher means, right? It's kosher to use it for a mitzvah, or it's kosher food, or it's a kosher sukkah, or it's a kosher korban, it's a kosher sacrifice. Whenever, that's when we apply the concept of kosher. Umutter means it's permissible versus when it's not permissible, right? It's food that's permissible to eat, or it's not, right? All these laws that are explained in the Mishnah, Hemal Yadei Chachma. What's the guiding force beyond the Mishnah? The Mishnah is the what? The Mishnah gives you the what? The Chachma is the why. There is a reason why God says kosher, not kosher. So, and the Chachma is the deciding factor. What, yeah, what, no. Now, but here's an important thing. This is like deep stuff. Chachma being the recipient of God, right? We said before, what's the characteristic of Chachma that allows Chachma to be the recipient? The characteristic of Chachma is its ability to become not. Chachma is nullification. It surrenders itself completely. Since Chachma is the essence of nullification to God, Chachma is the art of nullification. So when God's Or Ein Sof comes into Chachma, Chachma then, the divine Chachma, becomes the power here to invite. Now what's Chachma going to determine? What is the Torah going to determine? The Torah is going to determine which things are invited into on a simple level. Let's put it this way. So much packed over here, I'm sorry. On a simple level, Torah tells us what we can invite into our lives, what we can't, what we have to reject. Okay, for example, in a Jewish home, you have a stocked refrigerator, a stocked kitchen. Now, you can't bring everything into the kitchen. When if you're not keeping kosher, it's very easy to shop. You go anywhere, you take anything off the shelves. I mean, you want to obviously you're going to make decisions based on your healthy heating habits or whatever, your diet and so on, things. Some people are allergic to things, but that's what you're deciding. But as a kosher shopper, it's a whole different story. Your level of selection is on a whole different level. Basically, every single time you walked into the store, you're basically on your, men are always, when men go shopping, right? They're usually on the phone because they have no idea what they need to shop. And their wives tell them, or they're saying, or they're taking pictures of things and they're sending. And this is the way it works, right? It's really, women don't know of this. But men have a hard time shopping because, you know, they don't want to make mistakes. They don't want to get anybody upset. They want to do the right thing. But, you know, you have to know. To consult. As a Jew shops, he's consulting continuously. He's consulting with God. Okay? Not okay. Yet okay? Not okay. Can I? Okay. Technically, how does it work? You pick up various different items and you see if there's a rabbinical certification. That's the way it works today. In the olden days, it didn't work that way. But today's days, everything became commercialized. So the rabbis check out the companies that make all these products. And based on that, they'll tell you what's kosher and not. So there are kosher symbols. But if you really peel away the externality of it, you're not consulting a rabbi. Why is the rabbi your authority in life? The rabbi knows God's law. So what you're really shopping is you're consulting God. So you're really on the phone with God while you're shopping. This is a cool idea that came out in today's class. You're on the phone with God, taking pictures of items, sending it to him. God is texting you back. You can buy it. You can't buy it. Because this actually happens. Sometimes I find an item or my wife buys something and she sends it to me to check with the rabbi Nathanson. To check with him, because he'll tell me if this is if this product is okay, because if this kosher sign is a reliable kashrut signature, single knot. Some of them, you know, there's new ones popping up every day. Some of them are valid, some of them are not. So you want to check, you want to know if these items are kosher. What you're really doing is you're asking God, but what's the deeper meaning over here? What is the deeper meaning? So let's take this a little further. The deeper meaning is, what's the selection? The selection is that God, listen, if I'm buying these things, I should be concerned with, God is not eating this, I'm eating it. If I'm eating it, then I should be concerned of what's healthy for me. Do I like it? Do I not like it? Does it fit with my diet? Does it not fit my diet? That should be my concern. What has God's interest? Now, on the deepest level, it's not only because I want to live my life based on God. Is because when I am eating, God is eating it. Why? Because v'shachamti b'socham, this week's Torah portion, God says, I am dwelling inside of you. If I'm going to dwell inside of you, and I'm going to manifest myself in you, so I only let you eat something that could facilitate me. You can only eat something that could facilitate me. Because guess what? Who are we? What is our physical body? Our physical body is made up of the cans of tuna and whatever berries or food or salads or whatever it is that we ate 2 months ago or a month ago is now your body. This is literally your body. This is what your body is made of. We don't see it, but that's what it is. You're just a bunch of salad and beans and potatoes, and that's what we are. And challenge, right? This is our substance of our body. If God is going to... Oh, so God has selective. Now, what's the criteria? So it has to be divine criteria. What's the criteria? The criteria is like this. Whatever could accommodate God is allowed in. Whatever doesn't have it within it to accommodate God is not allowed in. The Torah says not. What could accommodate and what could not accommodate? Hear the depth of this. Something that has it within it to do a chachma stunt. Something that has it within it to be what? To nullify itself completely for God, to accept that God is and I'm not, then that entity is invited in. Because for God to dwell somewhere, he needs a complete nullification of that into God. The thing has to become aware that ain od milvado, there's nothing but God. Now here's the thing. The substances in the world, the physical, let's say, what are we eating? We're eating either animal or plant. So there are certain animals that the chemistry, the spiritual chemistry of this animal, that is the underlying DNA of the physical chemistry. The spiritual is coming from conditioned that if prepared in the right way, if used in the right manner, it could be assimilated into Chachma. It could nullify itself to God. The energy of it allows itself to accept the truth that He is and there's none but Him. It's willing to go along with Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. God is one. Hear, O Israel, God is the only reality. It lends itself to that philosophy. It accepts that. What is that? A chicken that's slaughtered in the proper manner under these circumstances, salted, and the blood is taken out through kosher salting and prepared exactly the way according to the Jewish ritual. That piece of chicken has it within it to accept the unity of God. Obviously, the person who's eating the chicken, the thoughts that they're having while they're eating it, and the later the energy that they're going to take from the food that they've gotten. In other words, you eat the chicken gives you energy. And the energy that you get is now going to become part of your prayer and become part of your acceptance that it got of you losing your completely dissolving your consciousness in the higher unity of God. You're taking the chicken along with you. Oh, so now the chicken is invited in. God says a lobster will never agree to it. Don't take the lobster, because the lobster, the spiritual energy of the lobster is one that is so rigidly opposed to the unity of God, it claims, you might not see it in the physical lobster, but the spiritual makeup comes from a spiritual force that denies the absolute unity of God, that doesn't want to surrender itself and say, God is and I'm not. So if you're going to eat, God forbid, the lobster, you can pray with all your energy in the world. The lobster cells or the lobster energy that's inside of you is not going to join your Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. It's not going to go into the oneness. It's going to remain outside of the oneness, and therefore it's going to be creating within your body a certain black hole where God cannot enter into that space. And therefore it doesn't belong in your life. That's the reason you have to consult God when you're shopping. Because He will tell you exactly which things can enter and which things cannot enter. How is God telling it to you? What's within God? Who is deciding that? Chachma is deciding that. Because Chachma, which is the first of the Sefirot, Chachma is the epitome of nullification. So Chachma takes one sniff and sees what, based on Chachma, Chachma gets to decide which things are willing to go along with Bittul, which means the nullification, and which things are not bitteldig. Which things are so egotistical, they're never going to bow down. And therefore you can't have them. It doesn't belong in a life which wants to become a home for God, which wants to become a vessel. If you don't want to be a vessel for God and you just want to live separate in the limitations of time and space and be a blip of an existence that's here today and gone tomorrow, gesunte, hey, do whatever you want. You know, enjoy yourself and eat and have a good time. But if you're a deeper human being and you recognize you have an opportunity to allow God to dwell in you and you become one with Him, you got to be very selective in that diet. And that's the meaning that he's saying over here. Chachma is biriru. Chachma does the birur. Chachma decides, the wisdom of God decides what has the capacity for bittul, and what does not have the capacity of bittul. Which animal, yeah, which animal, no. Which plant, yeah, which plant, no. But chachma is the concept, is the idea. The concept and the idea later goes down into God's, it starts in God's mind, in God's chachma, where the determination is made, What is willing to accept the bittul? What has a chachma potential to it? Bittul meaning the nullification and the surrender. And the chachma decides what doesn't have the potential for bittul. Okay? But then that later translates in the emotions, in God's emotions. What he says I want and what he says I don't want. In other words, when we are receiving the law, we're not receiving a dry, abstract concept. We are interacting in the Mishnah. When we're getting the law, we are interacting with God's tastes already. It's like, you know, in a relationship, your interaction with your spouse should be on an emotional level. There's passion, and there is excitement, and there is fervor, and there's energy, because there's the. But what is it based on? What are the emotions based on? Where are the likes and the dislikes of a person, of every person? What they find appealing, what they like to have, what they don't like to have. Right? There is some kind of deeper principles that kind of, you know, create the framework of a person's emotional structure. Now, when we're encountering the emotion. But I know the way my wife thinks. I know what her worldview is, what she appreciates, and based on that, I can figure out what her emotional reaction will be to this. So the actual interaction happens in the level of the emotion, but it's based on the concept. It's based on the mindset. So God's mindset, that's Chachmah, and based on that are the divine emotions. And the divine, and that's the Mishnah. And when we're experiencing the Mishnah, we're hearing God is very passionate when he says, yes, no, it's not dry. It's not like some, okay, yeah, you want to come close to me, don't come, you can sit there, you can eat the tray. No, God is saying, no, yes, give me that I want, that I don't want. It's oozing with infinite energy and passion and want. You should hear that when you learn the Mishnah. It's not just a cold science. It's powerful emotions, thundering emotions of yeah and no. The king is making a decree with his emotions. So now let's read it over here. Hem, so again, chol adinim kosher umuter, and all the laws of kosher umuter amavarim b'mishnah, he said, explained in the Mishnah, hem ayadei chachma is beridu, the chachma does the selection. Mevarer hatoiv mahara, and what's the selection? The selection is to look for what's good. It takes the good from the bad. What's the good from the bad? This world in general, the material physical world, is a world that its natural state is that it's not surrendered. It's not in a state of claiming God is and there's none but Him. The world is in a state of ego. That's the blanket reality of this world. But there is potential for elevation. There's potential for change. And God is the one who looks at the world and marks a check and an X. Which things are, you can elevate them into the unity, and which things cannot be elevated. That means it separates the good from the bad. The redeemable from the unredeemable. That's the concept of Chachmah. Umeir sham etzem agilui. And then it shines over there, in the Mishnah, shines the essence of the divine emotion of the revelation, umevader, and it clarifies upoisek hadin, and it hands down the verdict shemuter lechel. You're allowed to eat this food, and as we said before, what does it mean? You're allowed to eat something. Allowed to eat something means you can invite this into the unity of God. And through that particular food item or whatever it is becomes elevated and becomes attached into the unity. Or it tells you, no, don't bring that. That doesn't work. That doesn't work with me, God says. And on this it says, amazing. Vivdalten, you should separate between the kosher animal and the non-kosher animal. Simply is, that's what we're doing. Torah is the differentiator. Kosher, non-kosher, which as we said before, it's all based on Chachma's on the discerning eye of Chachma, which Chachma can tell where there is, where what has the potential for bittul and what does not have the potential for bittul. Ma she'en kein bebraisa. Now the way, one of the ways we can understand it, those who know, those who met real chassidim, people that have grown up with a real chassidic education, and they're real true chassidim, they have, a real chassid means someone who lives with bittul, whose entire enjoyment, his entire energy in life is the energy of surrendering his or herself to God joyfully. A complete surrender. That's a chassid. It's a hard word to say, bittul. It's a certain sharp and all-encompassing humility. And a very good... Now, a real chassid, if you have met a real chassid, they have the sharpest noses where they can immediately detect, like, when there is someone acting with self-interest and when someone is being, you know, egotistical in their religiosity, and they have such a distaste for it. It's like they have like this amazing, they schmeck immediately. Like we're in Hasidic terminology, it's called yeshus. Yeshus means an inflation of self. So, for instance, when they hear someone speak, the Ar Chassidim will immediately can tell if the person is about giving over the ideas, or they're busy about propagating their own existence by being sounding smart or so on. And people that are not born and bred in a deep way of Chassidim sometimes don't have, even if they're bright, they just don't have that sensitivity. Because when you live in the world of bittul, you have a sharp nose for bittul, and that's why we're saying chachma. Because chachma is the epitome of bittul, it can sniff bittul, potential for bittul, and where there is no potential for bittul, it right away, no, I'm not interested, rejection. So chachma is the determining factor that leads its way throughout all the emotions. The emotions are the actual where we encounter the will of God based on the bittul. But it says over here, you should separate. Now the question is, are we separating? God is doing the separation. He separated it. The Torah separated it. What do you mean you should? The pasuk seems to imply that the person should be separating. And the answer is no, we're separating it. Because when we are studying the Mishnah, we're activating this chachma to now manifest in this emotion. And at this moment, God is now saying kosher and not kosher. It's like, I'll give you an example. We all have a whole lot of emotions and likes and dislikes. But not always are these likes and dislikes activated. A lot of times feelings and emotions towards things are dormant. So for instance, you know, you can sometimes meet someone in a certain environment or in a certain type of a social setting, and the person is there. Why? Because they're there. And then you say to them, but I know you don't like this. You know, this is not your cup of tea. This is not your kind. It's not the environment. It's just not, aren't you someone who I know you. You're so not, you either can ask what happened to you, or the person who hears that will say, you know, you're right. This is so not me. And what happened is that you just triggered in them a feeling that they've always had, but it's like kind of like right now it hasn't been awakened because I'm not thinking about it. I'm not in that state of mind. I'm not in that space right now. But because you brought it up and you're emphasizing it, you're basically opening up that particular emotion or that particular feeling within the person because you're allowing it into the person's consciousness. And then they realize, I really don't like it. And then they're going to leave. They're going to leave that environment. I'm not going to stay there. Because you're showing, you're really telling them. Or sometimes you try to show somebody something and then they're not paying attention. Or even they're looking at it, they're not getting excited about it. And someone else comes over to them and says, I don't understand. You really love these things. I know about you. You really love, and then they hear it and they say, you know, that's really true. I really do like it. And they'll buy it or they'll get involved with it. Or they'll go to the event. Or you are the person who really likes it. So by telling them that they like it, what are you doing? You're just drawing their energy into that emotion. So here's the thing. God, as he manifests in the Torah, it's not like a dry, static state. It's something that we activate continuously. We have to draw him into his wisdom, and we draw him into his emotions. Obviously, these are his emotions. He's the one who gave it to us. But once they're there already, when we are learning it, when we learn that God dislikes something, we're actually creating that emotion within him or highlighting it, or that he's now feeling that, or that energy flow is flowing into divine emotion to reject that non-kosher entity or to embrace this thing. That's why it says, "Vihivdaltem," you should separate. This is the incredible cosmic effect we have when we study Torah. We are drawing God into an engaged, fully emotional engagement with the world, where his likes and his dislikes are very sharp, depending on which sugya you're learning. And when Jews all over the world are learning different mesechtos and different things, they're stimulating God on all levels of emotion. Because we're drawing the light into these or otherwise dormant channels. And now they become activated. So we're the ones who are, by studying Torah, causing the separation to happen between good and evil in the world, between right and wrong into the world. And that's why Torah study itself affects the world in an incredible way, moves the world closer and closer to where all that's negative and unholy will be removed, and all that's good and positive is now invited in and elevated. So obviously we do a lot through mitzvahs, but just learning itself is already activating the divine wisdom. It's causing God to think the thoughts. He thinks them along with us. As we say, when we study, he studies. And when we say Remeir Omer Tahar, Remeir says it's Tahar, we actually evoke within God his feeling that this is kosher and Tahar and pure, and therefore this is okay. And I should embrace this. He gave us the keys to his heart. That's the wild thing. To his mind and to his heart. We turn it on. And that's the meaning of Yivdalta. Okay, but this is in the Mishnah. Masha ain't came bebraisa, which isn't the case in the braisa. Ha'oreva gilui behem mu'etes. Ve'ein betadira. However, the braisa versus the Mishnah. Remember, we learned what braisa is. Braisa is the unedited statements of the sages that don't have, they're not the quality of the Mishnah, and they're considered outside of the Mishnah. Over there, although over there too, God flows, and when we study them, God is flowing to a certain degree in them, it's not bitadira, it's not so constant. It's like a person going to his concubine. Remember we said, 60 are the queens, 80 are the concubines. The Midrash tells us it's referring to the brise. So what's the brise? The brise is also a vessel for God. It's a vessel for God's will and God expressing his emotions, but to a lesser degree than the Mishnah. So what does that mean? So now we're going to get a little bit of a better understanding what that means. Ki ha-mishnayis, because the Mishnah, hem b'chinas chagas. The Mishnas are the chesed, gvura, teferes of God. They are the kindness, the severity, and the teferes, the beauty, which are considered the compassion, which are considered the primary emotions. Shem Kelem Emtsayim, which are the middle vessels. Teferes Gufa, which we say Teferes is the body. Ochem Brises. Now we're going to understand, again, let's read a couple of lines and then we're going to go back and to try to unpack this. Ochem Brises, however, the Brisa, Hem Bechinas Nehi. They are a lower level of emotion. They are the Netzach, the Netzach, the perseverance, the Hod, the glory, and Yesod, and the foundation element. Shehem levar magufa, they're considered outside the body. Kelim chitzonim, they're considered far more external vessels. Lechei nikra braisa, and that's why it's called braisa. Braisa means outside. Loshen chutza, which means to the outside. Umislapshim, and they become enclosed. Gam ba'asiya, also in the world of asiya. So he's differentiating two things. He says Mishnah has Mishnah versus braisa. Mishnah is the inside emotions, the chesed, gevura, teferes. The braisa is the netzachod yesod, which are external emotions. Please hold that. We're going to try to explain that. Stage number two. Mishnah is in the world of yetzira. Braisa, and it stays in the world of yetzira. Braisa enters also into the world of asiya, into the world of action, the material world. So what does that mean? Let's see. Okay, so let's stop over here for a moment and let's see. First, let's differentiate what that means. So there is, let's take the, obviously we're talking about the divine experience, which we're using the human experience as the metaphor for the divine experience. We discussed earlier, we have certain ideas in our heads, based on our ideas, our philosophies, our ways of thinking, the stuff we're exposed, the stuff we read about, based on the mind that we develop. Based on that, we create within our, we develop our emotions develop in our life. What we care about, what we don't care about, what we have compassion for, what we don't have compassion for. What we like, what we dislike. What we love and what we hate. What we want to be kind to and what we want to reject. Or whatever it is. Our emotions develop around what? Around our intelligence. Fine. There's the emotions, which are the love and the passions and so on and so forth. But then there is what's called netzach. Netzachod Yesod are the three lower emotions. We speak of six emotions, but there's a primary difference between the first three and the latter three. The first three are the emotions are excitement, how we feel about something. We're excited. It's a form of excitement. The Netzachod Yesod are not about the excitement or the feeling. They're about the implementation of the excitement. It's when the excitement goes into operation mode. That's Netzach Hod Yesod. So for instance, a person hears a very, very, very tragic story, God forbid. Something terrible happened. And you read about it and you're suddenly overwhelmed with very, very, very powerful feelings. You cry. You feel such empathy. You feel such care, so much for this individual who now suffered such a terrible catastrophe. And your heart is bleeding. So in that emotion, you're feeling yourself. You're feeling a lot of your energy. You're feeling that individual. You're feeling yourself too. You're feeling bad for them. And sometimes it bothers you so much you can't sleep. The emotion is like, it's really overtaking you. Or you keep on, like you're thinking about something else and suddenly you start crying for that individual because of that thing. Like we were all feeling for a long time after October 7th. We couldn't hold it in. It was so intense. Our emotions are powerful. But then the question is, what are you going to do about it? So here's where the next set of emotions kick in. And that is, the netzach means perseverance. It's when now that I'm feeling compassion, I need to do so. I have to help out. So how do I help out? So there were those people who picked themselves up after October 7th and they traveled to Israel. They must go and speak. And there were many people who went on trips. Every day there's people still going. Because people feel for those that are suffering and they want to go there. They want to help. They want to encourage the soldiers. They want to encourage families of the hostages. They want to do whatever they can. They go and they travel. So this trip that they made and they went and that's how they actualize, take their empathy and their caring and they actualize it in an action. Into doing mode. And then there are people who will open their pocketbooks and give money to the various different organizations that are going to send money to help these people that suffered. And others will say Tehillim, because I care and it hurts me so much, maybe I'll give money too, but primarily what I can do is I can say a lot of prayers and learn Torah in their merit and do as many mitzvot as I can in their merit. So we're driven to action as a result of the thing. So here's the thing. Obviously, right in the beginning, the primary emotions, the chesed, the love, the compassion, in the beginning flows into the active emotion. It's very strong. Even when it's going into the active emotion, it's very strong. But what happens is that being that the stage of action is already not so much about how you're feeling, but it's already about the other, so over there, the energy is already weaker. Once you're coming down to action, that's where we all find that the activities that we decide to do immediately after the tragedy happens, for a few days, we're very, very driven. And afterwards, we kind of sluggish off. But we might continue because of perseverance. We're still going to continue because we make a commitment. For example, if you made a commitment, for me, it was very hard. In the first few weeks, I was saying like a lot of Tehillim every day. And we even had a little program over here. We gathered together every morning. We were saying Tehillim. And then there was less people. And then, you're not under the intensity of the hostages like the first few weeks. We used to have Friday night's prayer over here. We were all holding the names of the hostages and we were like dancing with them. And it bothers me that it's kind of petered off because to those hostages, nothing changed. They're still in the same darkness. But because it's like this, because that's already, first of all, the emotion is there at the beginning. Then the Netzach is the perseverance. But then after I saw that our wonderful women over here did not stop saying the Tehillim, so I went back to it. So I'm still now saying every day, huge chunk, we're finishing Tehillim every week. I'm still at it. But I have to say that from week to week, it's becoming more of a determination. I have to fight myself like more and more and more to continue. I've done it. How long am I going to do this? How long is this work? You know, there's this extra chunk of Tehillim every day. And on the other hand, I want it. Some days there's more energy in the Tehillim. Some days I'm more there. I feel like myself more there. And some days it's dried out, but why am I doing it? Because it's a commitment. I committed myself for the time, and that's a commitment, it's a commitment. So always in the level of commitment, on the level of the emotions going into action, there is less of your soul in it. There is less pnimius hanefesh. The inner element of the soul is less. Just like in the body, in the head and in the torso, in the heart, there's more pumping energy. In the feet, the energy flow is less as we go to the lower parts of the body. What do I mean less? It means a more external part of your soul is in your feet, versus a more internal part of your being is in your brain, in your heart. So the intelligence, by the way, has the deepest, innermost of your soul is in the intelligence. The emotions is already a strat one level out. It's not as deep as a person's intelligence. And then the emotions that are regarding action are even less presence of soul. So the Alter Rebbe is saying over here in the Maimer, based on the Arizal, based on these Kabbalistic concepts, is as follows. The Mishnah is not so much about the detailed law. That's why we know you can't paskin from a Mishnah. The Mishnah gives you the outline of all of God's tastes. You get a general idea of what he likes and what he dislikes. That's what you get from the Mishnah. The Brisa is taking that down into practical observance. Because around every Mishnah, there's like 10 Brises, which give you so much more details, and the Talmud takes all these Brises together and creates so much more infrastructure, and we're going to see soon. The Talmud probes the reason of the Mishnah and comes up even with more hypotheticals and more, and through all of that together, you create the actual implementation of the concepts of the likes and dislikes of God into a practical, applicable science of life, into behavior. That's why we say like this. The Braisa is the Netzach Hod Yesod. It's not Chagas. It's not the emotions. It's the emotions already. In other words, in the Mishnah, there's so much more God's passion of what he loves, that's in the general. The Braisa is okay. It's like a person. When a person knows they love certain things, there is the emotion of it. And then there is based on, I'll give you another example. You have to take the examples as they apply to yourself. So in myself, for instance, I've been determined in the last year or so that I gotta start watching what I eat. Because no good, I'm gonna start behaving myself. I'm not gonna eat whatever is around. I have to. So there are times when I'm like really in the headspace of it. I'm getting on the scale once a week and I'm checking it and I'm losing. I'm not losing. I'm there. I'm on it. I'm getting on my bike. And I feel the excitement of the fact that I did pretty well. Took off 20 pounds. Not bad. And I'm in the emotion of it. But then there are the times when that's not, because you get busy, your head gets busy with the classes that you have to give and the other stuff that you have to do. And kind of loses, it's not at the center stage. But I made a commitment. And I determined that this is what I like and this is what I dislike. And you're committed. So in those commitments, right, as we said before, there's less energy. But it's only in those commitments is where it gets down to the practical. Because in the emotion, there's a lot of energy, but that's not practical. Unless you're going to break it down, unless you're going to take the desire of being healthier and you're going to actually break it down into behavioral changes, and very particular. It has to be particular. If it remains just like or dislike, it doesn't help. You have to break it down into daily routines. The daily routines are far more boring. They're far more whatever, but they lean much more into the real world. And that's the same thing he's saying over here. The Brises bring the Mishnah down into practical life. The Mishnah gives you the general idea of what God was excited about or not excited about. So, because of that, in the detail, and this is the way I understood this. Remember we said the concubine, sometimes the king is with her, sometimes he's not with her. And he's when he goes, it's more hidden, as opposed to the queen, who he's always with her. So what's the idea? We're saying that the Brisa says sometimes Hashem is there, sometimes he's not. What does that mean? Well, just like you see in ourselves, there are times when the detail, even the detail, the perseverance has energy. Sometimes it's easy when you determine something. Like you're excited and saying no. In the practical, I'm not going to eat that. Or I am going to take the time and make this more difficult type of food. I'm going to spend more time because it has to be healthy. So I'm going to, whatever. And then you're really like excited about it. You're in it. And there are times that you're so like, the energy is not in that action anymore. But you're still committed to it. That means that even in the world of Netzach, there are times when there is more pulsating energy in it, more self in it. And there are times when there's less self. The emotion itself is the emotion. The emotion always has you because the excitement is the excitement. But the netzachod has much less soul. And there are times when you're more in that emotion and there are times when you're less in that emotion. In the practical element of it. So what does that mean? There are times when God is more in the brisa and the times when God is less in the brisa. So what would that mean? So how do you know? You look at your Gemara, and when you start seeing it, maybe big tzaddikim, they can see the flashing stars around. They see the brises are really becoming now illuminated. It's like high tide. The tide is coming in. God is like filling those brises. I think it has to do a little bit with the person studying it. You know, with the type of Mishnah doesn't depend so much in your study and how invigorated you are and how excited and how in love with God you are when you're learning. Mishnah is the state of the emotions themselves, and you can know that God is always in the Mishnah. But in the Brisa, since it's already a far more outside level and it's far more there, so he can be more present or less present, but it's always holy and it's always godly. But the question is, how much of the pnimius of the Ein Sof is now flowing in that brisa when you're learning it? And that's what we mean. It's like, is the king with the concubine or is he not with the concubine? Is he there or is he not there? So let's read outside. Now let's go back to the words and see how this makes sense. Ki ha-mishnah yesem b'chinas chagas, the Mishnah is the chesed gvur teferes. Shem Kalim Emtzayim. These are the middle Kalim. What do I mean then, the middle Kalim? Chabad is considered the upper Kalim, the higher Kalim. The Netzach Hod Yesod, victory, foundation, glory, are the latter vessels. And the Chesed Gevura Teferis, they're the middle vessels. Teferis Gufa, Teferis is the body. And that, physiologically, it's also that way. If you look at a human body, there is the head is the upper part, the physical head. The feet are the bottom part of the person. And the torso, which holds the heart, where the emotions are, is the middle of the section. That's why it's called middle, Teferis Gufa. Och, in Braisas, however, the Braisa, Hem Chinas Netzachod Yesod, that's the Netzachod Yesod, Shehem Levar Megufa, they're outside of the body. Kelim Chitzonim, they're called the external vessels. Lechein Nikra Braisa, they're called Braisa. Loshen Chutza, that means outside. Umis Lapshim, they enclose Gamba Asiya, also in action. Why? Because the Braisa is much closer to the actual world down here, to observance. Because the Mishnah is still giving you just, it's like, you know, men with their wives a lot of times, you know, the man wants to hear from her, please stop just giving me your emotion. Just break it down to me. Give me instructions. Tell me what you want, what you don't want. Just don't give me the face of like, you're happy, you're not happy. That's just too broad. I don't know. Break it down into crumbs so then I know exactly the details. It has to be a detailed instruction. So that's the concept of it has to go for practical application in this world. It's not enough to encounter the Mishnah, which just gives you the general what rubs God wrong and what he really likes, but you have to bring it down into the detail. That's what the Braisa does. And therefore he says another very, very amazing idea, so much jam-packed in these lines. And that's why we find that the Braisa element became very prevalent and very much increased during the times of exile. What does that mean? Mishnah, although the Mishnah was also written only in the time of the exile, but the Mishnahs were already kind of formulating in the time when the temple stood. In the days of the temple, that's when you had already a lot of Tanoim. The earlier generations of the Tanoim, of the authors of the Mishnah, of the rabbis of the Mishnah, lived in the time of the temple. However, the Braisas are like they were formulated, developed, and kind of in the period after the destruction of the temple. It's hard to understand what that means because, in a sense, the Braisas and the Mishnas have the same rabbis. It's just the edited and the non-edited version. But it's like they're the same, Remeya, Rabbi Yussa, Rabbi Yossi. He brings this. So it's hard to understand what he means. It's maybe that it was the Mishnas were in their formulated form, they existed already earlier. Rebbe was the one who just collected them. But the Braises were like, they were taken from tidbits that they put together after, from little pieces as they put together these teachings that were not formulated in the actual words in the time when the temple stood. They're a product of the next generation or the next generations. And the reason for that is because, here's the deal, ki oz mote raglin beraglin, because the time of the exile in general is a time of feet. It's the time when the feet enter into the realm of the feet. The feet engage with the feet. What does that mean? What that means is like this. I don't know what that means. You know, I'm going to make an attempt to try to, suggest what it means. It means something to the effect as follows. Just like we discussed earlier, that the Sefirot, the divine attributes, exist in all worlds. There's 10 Sefirot in every world. Yet, the primary manifestation of Chachma is primarily in the world of Atzilut, in the world of emanation. It's a world that's totally one with God. The world of Bria is dominated by what? the world of Bria is dominated by Bina, right? Bina is Bina manifests in Bria, in the world of Bria. The emotions manifest in Yetzirah. And what's the energy of this physical world, of the material world? Malchus. Malchus is in the world of Asiya. Okay? So just like there is Sefirot, and Sefirot is in every world, but there's the primary manifestation of that Sefirah in a certain world. So just like it is in space, it's also in time. That means that there are certain, within you, within the history of the world, there are times when these particular Sefirot are highlighted. These are the Sefirot that are the main energy of the world during that era. Then there is another era where the energy of the world, the energy of the time, of the period, of the era, is a different type of energy, of a different Sefirot. And then finally, for example, let me give you the example just in a simple way. We know that the sixth millennium correspond to the sixth of history, to the six emotions. So we say the first 1,000 years, it was primarily God's kindness that was dominating, that was actualizing itself in creation. The second 1,000 years was Gevura. That's why it was very harsh. There was the flood and big punishments, because God's judgment was then very active. The third millennium was Teferes, beauty, compassion. That's when God gave the Torah to the world and the like. The other one, so you go through the millennium. You see each millennium, even though all six emotions are there all the time, but there is highlighted. So the same is also, in another way of it being, is that at the time of the temple, the divine emotions, the inner emotions of God, were very dominating. In other words, in the world, his interaction with the world was in a very emotional, exciting way. To put it in other words, or clearer, we should say something like this. I give an example. Like any relationship. There are times in a relationship that there is a lot of love and there's a lot of emotional engagement between the couple. They're deeply, they feel each other very strong and they engage in a very strong emotional bond. And there are times that the emotion, for whatever reason, gets a little, that the husband or the wife or both of them get a little withdrawn. And they're not that available to each other emotionally. They step out, the emotions kind of go like a little bit silent. And what's there that keeps the relationship intact? The commitments. They're committed to each other. So they're engaging with each other. He's still showing up and she's showing up. She's doing everything she needs to do as a good wife. He's doing everything he needs to do as a good husband, but it's mainly him doing and she's doing. They don't have that spark and that romance like they were. So the same is with God. During the time of the temple stood, God was in an emotional relationship with the world. That means that God's emotions were flowing in the cosmos. So the rabbis who lived in those days were able to tap God's emotions and thereby formulate the Mishnah. Was the Mishnah, because they can sense God's emotions. If I want to write a sketch on your emotions, I can do that. If you're engaging with me with your emotions, if you're withdrawn, I won't be able to sketch out your emotions. So the fact that the rabbis were able to give us the divine emotions is because they lived in a period during the temple when God's emotions were flowing and interacting with the world. Time of exile, the emotions were withdrawn. And what's left of God in the world is God's feet. Which means the flow of divinity in the world, compared to earlier, is primarily his commitment. His commitment to keep the world going and the like. And therefore, here's the thing. When the temple stood, the main worship, the main connection on our end to God was in the heart. In other words, everything was about experience. If you live in the time of the temple, You came up to the temple. Your heart melted. Spiritual, powerful emotions overtook the person when they went to the temple. You experienced such intense passion and love. You experienced such exhilarating joy. You experienced the highest levels of awe and fear, of trembling in front of God. And that took center stage. Of course, there was behavior as well. Of course, they did the mitzvot. But the mitzvot were not as... It wasn't so much about practice. It was very much about the bond. Prayer was so powerful. And you didn't need a prayer book. You came and your soul prayed. Your own language. It was before the prayer book that was made. Because it was on the level of emotion. Once God's emotions kind of like withdraw, and Hashem is now interacting with his feet, our connection to God is also with our feet, and that is mainly behavior, action. Now what's primary in Judaism, until Mashiach comes, is not your experience. Now what's most important in Judaism is our behavior, feet by feet. But it's not like, oh, it would be so much better if we can have an emotional bond with God, better than just practice, than behavior. It's intentionally that way. Exile is intentional because there's a lot of work we need to do with our actions. And if we would be living in a world of experience, we would be lost in the experience. We would not do the actions. I'll give you an example, even from our world. If you learn a little bit about the earlier days of Hasidim, the Baal Shem Tov's Hasidim, the Alter Rebbe's Hasidim, the Rebbe Rashab's Hasidim, these people spent hours upon hours upon hours davening. Their emotions and their bond to God was so much, and that was great, and that was their avoda. But they didn't get that much done. Imagine if they would stay this way, and Chabad, the seventh generation, would be the same generations and the same... Would we have all the Chabad houses and would we have all the tefillins and all the mitzvahs and all? We wouldn't. It's impossible. If you're davening 14 hours a day, we wouldn't have time for it. So the shluchim, the Rebbe shluchim and all the Rebbe's emissaries are not davening 15 hours, although we should put more effort into davening. But that's not where, because it's not at that place right now. Now it's the final generation before Mashiach. We got to pick up the final sparks, and those final sparks are buried in the material physical world. So you need to do material physical actions. It's intentional that way. And when Mashiach comes, we're going to get back into the higher levels of our bond with God, into the experiential experiences. So he's saying the Brisa became very prevalent and very, very much, it came during the time when the exile started, because that's when Netzach Hod Yesod starts kicking in, because Netzach and Hod are the feet. We're going into the feet. We're going into practice. We're going into a Judaism of more of behavior than of experience. Because that's what needed to rectify the world. To rectify the world of Asiya, the world of action, you need Brisa. Not so much Mishnah. The Brisa is based on the Mishnah. You need Brisa because Brisa can instruct you on action, on what you should do and what you shouldn't do. It's taking it down. It's bringing it down. Like we said earlier, that the Netzach and the Hod is taking your emotion and doing something about it. Not just feeling bad for someone. What are you going to do about it? It's the action. Elchein ha'odava gili ben... So therefore he says, L'chein esrabu ha-braisis tafka b'zman ha-golos, and that's why the braisis became increased only in the time of exile. Ki oz moti raglin b'raglin, that's when the feet engage with the feet. P'chinas nehi netzach od yisod, L'chein ha-odav ha-gili b'emil, that's why there's far less energy over here. In the time, in braisa there's much less energy. In behavior, it's not as enjoyable, but that's where the work is at. Achim mikoidim, however, we have to realize that just like whenever an emotion flows into behavior, or into the emotions of behavior, the commitments we make in behavior, all these commitments are really included first in the emotion. Ostensibly. If you have compassion for someone, and then in the end you take out your checkbook and you write a check, and that's part of your perseverance of the emotion, and sometimes it could be that you were very emotional about it, you cried and cried and cried, and then a week later, like, the emotion dried up, and then you said, you know, I didn't do anything about this. I'm so busy crying, and I didn't do anything. So now you feel I have to do something. But because it's not so exciting to do, it's more exciting to cry or to feel. So you kind of forget about it, and then you realize, I still didn't do anything. It's like 2 weeks later, I still didn't write the check. Or a lot of times you wrote the check, but you didn't put it in the envelope. Or you had the check, you put it in the envelope, but you didn't find the stamp, so you didn't do it. And by now, like, it's like that you see the check every day. Meanwhile, this person needs your help. The person spoke to you. You felt so bad, you cried for them. Everything. They need, and meanwhile, the check is sitting on you there because the energy is not so much there in the Netzach. It's when the emotion is still raw and there, you felt it's about yourself, how you feel about the other person. And it feels good because you're feeling compassion. A person likes to feel their emotions. It's you feel alive. But now it comes to the Netzach. But there, as we said before, the energy dries up in the Netzach, and that's why sometimes it takes a while to actually do something that is. However, whatever energy there is in the Netzach, whatever the Netzach is, the perseverance is. This perseverance energy was once part of the excitement. Just like an emotion was once part of the intelligence, remember? We said the intelligence creates the emotions. The emotions, the inner emotions, create the outer emotions. So too, all the brises are all included in the Mishnah. That's why the Gemara says, is there anything in the brisa that is not in the Mishnah? Because the general emotion, the general feeling that you have, contains within it all the avenues that you will eventually express. Because it's the force, it's the excitement that drives all that behavior. So it's all there. Everything was first in the Mishnah. Like Ilfa said, Ilfa was one of the sages of the Gemara. Is there anything in the Braisa that's not in the Mishnah? Fine. Now we're going to examine. So Braisa has a quality. But in terms of communicating with God and having God manifest himself completely in you, Mishnah has it to a greater degree. Because Mishnah, you're allowing God's emotions to open up inside of you. And the emotions is where the energy flow of the soul in the emotions is very intense. And if the emotion is there, the soul is always in that emotion. Versus in the practical emotions, in the motorized behavior, as we said before, it's there is less presence of soul. In this case, less presence of the Ein Sof. However, it's needed because only through the Braisa do we get to actually fix the world. Are we bringing it down more into action? Now we need to. By the way, I just want to say one thing. Why the number 80? When it comes to the concubines, the Mishnah we said, why 60? Because there are 6 emotions, and each emotion has all 10 sephirot in it. So there are 60 tractates in Mishnah, because the emotions, when we open them up particularly, you have 10 different facets of every emotion. So 60 Mishnahs, 60 tractates. Okay. Why 80 in the Braisa? So he doesn't, in this version of the Maimer, we don't have it, but in the version of the Mittel Rebbe, in Tuf Kuf Ayin, there's a very beautiful version of the same Maimer, but in the words of the Mittel Rebbe, how he writes it. And over there, he does say why the 80 Mishnah. Because he explains, you have the 6 emotions of Yetzirah, plus the Netzach and the Hod that go down in Asiya, Braisa, has the 6 emotions, but including the 2 feet that go out. Even though the 6 already, if you're saying 6, you're already including Netzach and Hod in the 6. But there is the Netzach, there is the Chesed, Gevura, Teferes, Netzach, Hod, Yesod, as they are in their place, as they're part of the emotion. And then there is the Netzach and Hod as they're going out of their place, and they're no more about emotion, they're more about practical observance or practical action. So you add another two, the Netzach and the Hod, and each one has another 10, just like each one of the six has 10. So it becomes from 60, it becomes 80. That's why the Brises are the 80 concubines. What we're left now to understand is, why do we say that the statements of the Talmud, the Gemara, are the young girls without an end? Remember we said, the verse says, and the young women that are hang out in the palace, but they're not the queens, they're not the concubines, they are just the girls that are in the palace. So what does that mean? And these are the statements of the Talmud. So he's now going to explain something phenomenal. How the Talmud is higher than everything, but because it's high, precisely because that, it has a disadvantage. It has an advantage and a disadvantage. What's the advantage and the disadvantage of the Talmud? What is the Talmud attempting to do? I'm going to say it in a very short point. The Talmud is very ambitious. The Talmud is trying to go past the emotions and reach the divine intelligence. So it's climbing very high. And it doesn't just attempt. It actually goes into God's mind and figures out what God is thinking. What's God's philosophies? What's the reasons why he has... It's like the Talmud is trying to be God's therapist and to go into God's emotions and try to uncover, like, what's the underlying reasoning for the... Why do you feel this way? what did you experience in your life back then that you're feeling this way? Like, what's your real story in the mind? It's trying to probe God's mind. And it achieves that. It reaches into the reasoning. But precisely because of that, it doesn't achieve such a union with God like God in the emotions, like in the Mishnah. Even though there's much more soul in a person's intelligence than there is in a person's emotions. Just like the head has, like the main energy of the person is in their head and then less in their heart. So the intellect is the deepest part of the soul. So the light of the soul that is in the Chabad, in the Chachma Bina Das, is much more light of the soul that is in the Chagas, in the emotion. So if the Gemara is the Chabad, the reasoning of the Torah, and in therefore it's in the world of Bria, which the world of Bria is where God's intelligence, so why isn't it, it should be that this is the real queen. She's the closest. The answer is, because it's the intelligence, and the intelligence of God is so high that it does not lend itself to finite vessels. So you might be able to poke at it, but you're not really able to assimilate it. The emotions of God, because emotions are far less than his intelligence, are communicatable into our vessels. So we are able to, so the Mishnah, what's the Mishnah? The Mishnah are the vessels of Yetzirah. The vessels, the Sefirot of the world of Yetzirah. Yetzirah is already closer to us. It's the world of formation. It's already more finite. But the which vessels are, let me put it this way. The vessels of Yetzirah become more unified with God's light than the vessels of Bria. Even though the vessels of Bria are much higher, but because the light of Bria is such a higher light, it's too intense for the vessels to take it. So even though the vessels, it shines in the vessels, it hovers a little bit. It's not as assimilated with the vessels. It remains above. So we're swimming, we're touching this higher light, but we're not really taking it in. And that's why it's considered like a girl, in a sense, like a virgin, who did not receive and internalize the hashpa. In Yetzirah and in Mishnah and even in Brisa. In Mishnah, God is fully present. In Brisa, less. But when he's there, he really fills the vessels. But in Gemara, in Talmud, even when we conceive the idea, it's like learning something, but I guess it's like learning this discourse. It's like you're learning it, but you feel like this is over your head. Whoever doesn't feel that way, that's phenomenal. You must be a very, 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 very refined. And we realize that these are very, very, very high concepts. We're learning. We have the merit to read these holy words and to dabble in them. But these are such magnificent, holy, godly concepts. And we know that when we're learning it. And let me give the simple differentiation. Where do you feel you're touching a higher part of God? When you're learning Kabbalah or mysticism or Hasidus, or when you're learning law, Torah law? You realize that when you're learning Hasidus, you're learning the subject matter of the divine. You're learning higher Torah. You're learning mysticism. You're learning Kabbalah. You're learning the secrets. This is a much higher Torah. But where do we understand it better? If you're sitting and learning Gemara versus mysticism, you're learning, of course, you were able to assimilate the ideas in the revealed part of the Torah much better because we know what we're talking about. You can discuss it really well. You can really get to the full understanding of a concept because it's a lower concept. Since it's a lower concept, we're able to assimilate it much more with our vessel. So what he's saying is Gemara, in terms of the godliness of the Talmud, is much higher. But precisely because of that, it doesn't settle so much into the vessels. So therefore, the teachings of the Amoraim, which are the sages of the Talmud, are women that are receiving the light of the king, but they're not internalizing it all the way. And therefore, when we are learning it, we have the merit to go so high. We're going into God's mind, but we have to understand the limitations of going into God's mind. It won't be the same like going into God's emotions. God's emotions are transmittable into the vessels of the world to a certain degree. But God's intelligence are not transmittable. And yet God allows us to shares with us something, but we realize that because it's so high, we will only be able to peek at it from a distance. So that's what he's explaining over here. That's why you also find, for instance, no, let's leave it on. Valomo, he said, what are the young girls that we spoke about? Halacha is Talmud Bavli. These are the laws of the Babylonian Talmud. So watch this amazing thing. The Talmud Bavli is called, the sages say, there's a verse that says, "Bamachashakim hoishivani, in darkness you have placed me." So the Talmud says, when it says, "In darkness you have placed me," that is the Talmud, that's the Babylonian Talmud. Babylonian Talmud is called, "In darkness you have placed me." That's very hard to understand. If there's anything that's darkness, the Talmud, that's the greatest, brightest entity ever. We have such incredible divine wisdom in the Talmud. How can it be called darkness? The answer is, but because there's such a bright light shining in the Talmud, it's so bright that it's dark. Because the light of the divine intelligence is not where we are only barely, you know, tapping it. That's the idea. How does Talmud Bavli work? Questions are asked and answers are given. New laws. Now, how does the Talmud, if you have to go, Don't stay. I can do, you know, this. It's always the rule. It's a marathon. First days, you know, you ran half the marathon. That's also good. Three quarters. Because this is how it goes. Al Yadesha Moisef, when you ask, Umafarik, and you answer, So what happens is in the Talmud is there's a lot of questions and answers, back and forth, back and forth. And what happens then? Based on the questions and the answers, he's got his head on. Based on the no, really, I really mean it. This is not going to end. We're going to go on and on and on. Based on the questions and the answers in the Talmud, there is you get the Talmud asks back and forth, and based on getting the reason of the Mishnah, the Talmud comes up with a whole lot of new scenarios, which it deduces, and it creates new laws. It deduces it based on the logic, which as, if you only learned the Mishnah, you wouldn't understand the logic of the Mishnah, then you would kind of be within the certain framework of the Mishnah. In other words, the laws would only be, the laws would only be a particular, a very particular set of laws. But then, once you get the reason of the Mishnah, then the Talmud can say, well, if that's the case, so in a case like this, and a case like that, and so it broadens the laws. That's why the Talmud produces so much more laws than the Mishnah itself has. Because it's going into a, it's going into the, to the, to the, it's when you know the reason of something, then you can discover far more applications. For example, when someone has an emotion that's not good for them, it's not a good emotion, and they try to figure out, and they do therapy, and you uncover the thought process, the concept, the idea that's there that's driving this emotion, that's the fuel of the emotion. So then you can say, well, you know what, this idea, if it's if you can. It's not a bad thing. It's just that it needs, you have to, you can actualize it in a different manner. You can create a different setting for it. And you kind of create another emotion or another, you can direct the, through thinking, you can direct that very same concept. Once you know the concept behind it, it creates the possibility for much more variation. As opposed to, when you're just dealing with the actual emotion itself. So going deeper into the cause of the emotion opens up much more possibility. So it's the same as when we probe God's emotions, we open up so much more nuance to it. Umadama milsa la milsa, and you compare one thing to the other. So, okay, that's what the Talmud is. The Talmud and the Talmud, as the Arizal says, Bibriya is in the world of Bria. It's in, which means it's not the world of Yetzirah, which is the seat of the divine emotion. It's a higher world, the world of the divine intelligence. That's where the sages ascended up to bring us the Talmud. Their spirit, their souls of the sages of the Talmud were rooted in the world of Bria, and when they taught, they taught their teachings, bringing their logic and because obviously it's a godly logic, down from the world of Bria. Which in the world of Bria is the Chabad is shining over there, the wisdom. Most of the places in Chassidus it says Bina shines in Bria. But in as much as Bina is a facilitator of Chachma, so we can say that the Eberstus Chachma is also shining there. Just like Hashem's Chachma shines all the way down into the emotion, so it definitely shines into the logic, into the Bina. Like it says in Eitz Chaim, Ima, the Bina, the mother, when he says the Eberstus Chachma is there, he means primarily the intelligence, not so much Chachma versus Bina. Because as he brings now, like it says in Eitz Chaim, Ima, the level of mother, which is the level of Chabad, Mekanena Bebriya, nests in the world of Bria. Okay. Vinikra, so let's understand. Why is it then, so if the Talmud is in such a high level, so it would mean something that's closer to God. So why are we calling it Almin? Almin means concealment. This is not concealment. This is divine revelation. If I only know your emotion, but I don't know the why, then that's concealment. But if you can tell me not just your emotions, but I can get to see the reason, the underlying world view and mindset that you have that's creating these emotions, that means you're much more revealed to me. I know you so much better. So why is it called concealment? V'nikra almin lashon helam, concealment. Well, we find a parallel to that. We find another example that a higher world where there is more light is concealed, is called darkness. And a lower world where there's less light is called light. Total opposite. A higher world where there's so much more light is called darkness. And a lower world where there is less light is called light. Where do we find that? In our prayer we say, like it says, Yotzer Or, that God forms light, and then there is and we say Ubore Choshech, and he creates darkness. So we see it uses the term Yotzer, which is the synonymous and related to the world Yetzira, and it relates to the world of Yetzira. And over there we say Or, light. Zau Yetzira, Ubore Choshech, and he creates darkness. The world of Bria is called darkness. What is the reason? What can be the explanation for this, that Bria would be called darkness and Yetzira would be called light? Because Yetzira shasham nekanen and vav ktzav es tatzilos, because Yetzira is the world where the six emotions, the six directions of the world of Atzilos, the divine emotions. These are God's emotions. They're able to descend and to be enclosed. Why? They can make their way down all the way into the finite vessels of creation. The recipient is able to receive the kindness. The emotion of kindness is transferable or transmittable into a finite vessel. Obviously, in a limited capacity. But in a limited capacity, something of the infinite kindness can come down. Because emotion is a little bit of is more external. Bemida chesed mamish, bemida umargish atoiv. You can sense the kindness. And you can really internalize that kindness. Even though we can't compare the kindness of the world of Atzilus, of the world of emanation, cannot be in any way compared to the kindness of the world of formation. Again, let's stack the four worlds. Atzilus is the world of emanation. It's the divine. It's purely, it's one with God. It's infinite. And we're saying that what? That originally when we're saying God's emotions, we're referring to the emotions of Atzilus, like I mentioned much earlier. However, when we're learning the Mishnah, we are encountering these emotions as they manifest in Yetzira. As we said earlier, the emotions of God as they are in a purely godly state is not speaking to us. Once it's translated into God's emotions are being applied to the world, to the finite, means they are enclosing themselves in a creation like setting, which is the world of Yetzirah. So the question is, how much of the light of Atzilus can actually translate into the created realm? Atzilus is the divine realm, and Yetzirah is the created realm. If Atzilus wants to, or not if, but when Atzilus wants to manifest itself into a finite vessel, how much can those emotions actually transmit? And the answer is, yes, some of the substance of the emotion could be transmitted. And the recipient is able to really absorb it and receive it. The vessels, the finite vessels of Yetzira are able to capture it. Ki bi Yetzira hem balei gvul, because in Yetzira there is already a limitation. And Atzilus is still infinite. Afal pikein, even though Yetzira is a real gavul, is a real limitation already. Afal pikein shayach loshen oyer. You can call it light. Shah makabel makabel al buryoy. The recipient is receiving it buryoy, which means thoroughly. whatever is being transmitted is fully assimilatable into these finite vessels. Because it's only the emotions of God versus the intelligence, which is far deeper and higher, and does not transfer well into finite vessels. And it's like, you know, a lot of times, you know, emotions in general are very showable on the outside. You know, you can sense very much when the person is upset, or you can sense very much in words that love can come through words. But you can't always share with someone else and explain to them why you feel that way. That's like much deeper in you. It's very hard to explain that. So the other will know what you're feeling, not will necessarily understand why that is. But you find it's hard to articulate that, because it's too deep. However, God's wisdom is not able to descend so much below. And that's why, even when you're sharing with me somewhat of your mind, it will be vague. It will remain aloof. It will remain swimming above my head. Everything that, when the Chabad of Atzilus tries to transfer itself to the Chabad of Bria, most of it gets lost. Or not that it gets lost, it's just the vessels don't take it in. So therefore, in those vessels, it's still dark. The light is not really manifesting. So it's like you're seeing something, but you're not seeing clearly. Elchein, kol mashem masig asaga, everything that you're understanding, ein masik l'shor shel amka, you're not getting it to its depth, to its root, and to its depth. Ki chachmasa yu binasei v'daitoi, because the levels of chachma shel orin sof baruch hu sheba atzilus, of the orin sof that's in the world of atzilus, eino yachol lavei behizgalus kelim bali gvul, is not able to come in a revealed way into vessels that are finite. Since Bria is already finite, so the containers of the world of Bria are not able to fathom God's mind. Because by Chachma we say, Chabad we say, Chakim v'loy b'chachma yediyah. That is, wisdom is without a knowledgeable wisdom, which means it's not knowable. It's a wisdom that's beyond any knowledge. So how can it be known in finite vessels? L'chein af shalamay l'ba'atzilos sham chachma meyer yoyser. So let's understand something. In Atzilos itself, in Atzilus itself, which vessels are brighter? See, let's introduce one more idea, very important. In every sphera and every attribute, there is light and there are vessels, containers. And so is in each world. In the 10 spheres, there's the light and there is the vessels. In Atzilus, which vessels are brighter? Chabad vessels, the vessels of God's intelligence, or the vessels of God's emotions? In Atzilus, the vessels of the divine intelligence are much brighter, far more illuminated than the vessels of the divine emotions. But in the world of Bria, the vessels of Bria are darker and less illuminated than the vessels of Yetzirah. Or, even in Bria, let's put it this way, even in Bria, the Chabad vessels are darker than the Chagas, than the emotional vessels. And why is that? Because Atzilus, the vessels of Atzilus are completely one with God. It's so to speak, God's body. Atzilus is God's body. Even though it's a body, but it's God's body. And that body is able to assimilate the light. Since the light of the intelligence is much more light than the light of the emotions, so when you have vessels that are able to take the light, then the lights of the vessels of the intelligence are much brighter than the vessels of the emotions, because these vessels are able to take the light. But when God is now trying to translate these energies and these illuminations into a finite translation, the lower energies are easier transformed into the lower world and the higher ones. So when the higher ones arrive in their vessels, they remain. The vessels don't connect so much with the lights. The lights and the vessels remains to a certain degree separated. And that's why the vessels are considered dark. Because the vessels have not. So it's almost, let's say like this. Within a person himself, the light in your own mind, there is much more illumination than in your heart. In your intellectual powers, there is more light than in the emotional powers. But when it comes to transmitting that to someone else, the emotions can be felt more by the other than the illumination of the intellect. The words he uses in the other mimer, he doesn't say it so much over here, but in the other version that I mentioned earlier. You see that when you're emotional and you're talking with emotion, let's say when you're very emotional, you're talking with emotion, the words themselves that are being spoken, the people can sense the emotion itself. You can hear when someone is cracking up, and that's why we say words that come from the heart go into the heart. You can cause people to cry. You can give, when you're speaking with compassion or with empathy, that empathy can become so strong, and the person that hears those words, it's basically your emotion enters their heart. They feel it. They can feel the love. But when you're speaking intelligence, although you're transmitting ideas, but the words themselves, you can't sense the person gets those words and they can think on those words and then understand the same idea you're understanding. But the intelligence itself is not your intelligence. Your understanding is not sensed by the recipient. They're getting the words, and from the words they can deduce the intelligence. Why? Because the light of intelligence doesn't go into words as much as the light of emotions. Emotions can enter into the letters themselves. The letters themselves are dripping with emotion, intellect. The emotions are carrying the intellect, but the intellect doesn't go into the words as much as the emotions go into the walls of the words, into the material of the words. The vessels don't become so saturated with it as the emotions do. The vessels that carry the emotions become more unified with the emotions than the vessels that are carrying the intelligence. That's if it has to be carried outside of you. But within the person himself, of course, the vessels of intelligence have more light than the vessels of emotion. So in Atzilus, of course, Chabad is much stronger than Chagas, than Chesed, Gevurah, Teferis. But when it's being translated into Bria, Yetzirah, and Asiyah, there is an advantage in the emotions. That's why Mishnah is so special. Because Mishnah, The whatever the godliness that's there is fully in those words. And when you learn it, you're literally experiencing God in a way that you cannot when you're trying to get into a higher space in the divine and get to God's head. That's, you have to accept the fact that you're going to be looking at it from a distance. You're not going to get, be able to get so up and close when it comes to his mind. As he says, and let's read again. B'chinas chachmasa, ein yachal l'shtal shel kach lamat, is not able to go down so low. L'chein kol ma shemasig asog ein amasig l'shar sheli amkoi. Everything that you understand, you're not understanding to its root and to its depth. Ki chachmasa bin evinas v'dat shel erein tzev baruch hu sheba atzilus, because the chachma bin adas of atzilus ein yachal lavoi b'iz galus b'keilim b'alegvul, is not able to lower himself down into vessels that are limited, chakim v'loy b'chachma yadiyah, because his wisdom is not in a knowable wisdom. L'chein af shalamayla b'atzilus, even though in atzilus itself, sham chachma meyer yoyser, chachma is more luminant there, avo b'izgalus lamata, when it's translated below b'briya, in the world of briya, the world of creation. Balei gvul, which is a limited place, nikra, it's called boirei choshech, it's called in briya is darkness, the yetzira nikra oir, and yetzira is called light, because emotions, the finite realm is able to receive, but intellect, the finite realm, is not able to receive. And that's why on the Talmud Bavli it says a word, a phrase from limitations. In darkness he has sat me. That the Talmud Bavli is called darkness. Why is it called darkness? Because it's going to a very high place where it will never be able to fully assimilate the ideas that it's trying to assimilate. But the very fact that it's dabbling in them is awesome. Since the Talmud is the reasons of the Mishnah and God's wisdom, this is the darkness. It's not able to come to a revealed state that we should understand the reason really well. And that's why we also find another interesting expression of this idea. We have two boxes of tefillin. When we wear the special boxes that Jewish men put on to, every morning when they pray, besides on Shabbat, during the weekday, is one box that goes on the hand, the phylacteries, or phylacteries, I mean. One of them goes on the hand over here, and one goes on the head. So we know that the holiness of the one on the hand is of a lesser holiness than the one on the head. Yet we know that when you say Yotzer Or Ubora Choshech every day in our prayer, when you say the words Yotzer Or, he creates light, you kiss. You're supposed to touch, feel the hand to fill in and kiss it. Like you put your hand to it and then give it a kiss. And when it comes to the bo rechoshech, he creates darkness, you touch the head to fill in. So it's an interesting thing. It would seem to imply that the hand to fill in, which is much lower, is called light. And the head to fill in, which is holier, is called darkness. So it would be the opposite. Darkness is lower than light. The answer is no. Because the head tefillin is trying to capture something so high, it's not saturating the actual physical box as much. So the tefillin itself, the physical box of the tefillin of the head, is not shining so brightly. It's not so luminous like the tefillin shel yad. Tefillin shel yad is a more luminous vessel. But that's because the light that's inside of it is not such a bright light, so the vessel is able to take it. But the tefillin shel rosh is attempting to assimilate something much higher. So, although it's a much greater light, but the vessel is more dark. The keli is more dark. Shenikra or shemeir, because in the tefillin shel yad, and you can see it, in the hand tefillin, it's put by the hand, but it's not about the hand, it's about the heart. It's right across the heart. Because that's where God's emotions are. So when you're wearing tefillin, God is saying, my heart and your heart, we're touching each other. So it's God's heart, God's emotions, touching our heart. Very close. But that is transmittable. The shalrosh is God's mind. So we can understand God's mind is so lofty that it's not... It's called He creates darkness. Because the revelation of God's wisdom comes in a more concealed way, the Ein Meir Begilui Mamish, and it's not shining in such a revealed way. The Efshar Lahav in Inyan Zeh. Now we read the parentheses. We can understand this concept, Al Derech Dugma, another example to this idea that we're explaining. Memashan is Barba, Makam Acher, this that was explained elsewhere, Be Inyan Asplaklaria Hameira, Vasplaklaria She'ena Meira. Where it speaks about looking through a clean glass and looking through a frosted glass. There it's talking about two types of prophecies. There is I think it's the Talmud. Yeah, the Talmud is in Tractate Sanhedrin. Asks, No, that's not there. Trying to think where this is. I'm not sure where this is from, but it's a statement of the sages where they ask the question that we find that we know Moses was the greatest prophet, and then we know that Isaiah, Yeshaya, was also a great prophet, but he can't be compared to Moses. Now Moshe, when it says that when Moshe says, "Can I see you, God?" and God says to him, "No one, kilo yirani adam v'chai, no one can see me and stay alive." And Isaiah says, "Ve'era esavaya, I saw God." So the Talmud says Moshe, who's a much higher prophet, can't see God, and Isaiah, and God says to Moshe, "You can see only my back, not my front." And Isaiah, who's a much lesser prophet, could see. So the Talmud answers that Moshe was looking at God through a clean glass. So to look at God, his prophecy was compared to a clean glass. Looking through a window that's absolutely clean. So with such a clear vision, you can't see God, you can only see his back. Isaiah was looking through a frosty glass, like a translucent, not a transparent glass. So through that, he was able to see God. Not his back, even his front. Whatever that means. But means a higher level. So that's exactly what we're learning. Because, see, Moshe is like Mishnah, and Isaiah is like Talmud. Yeshaya is like Talmud, and Moshe is like Mishnah. Because Moshe is his vessels, it's a vessel that's going to actually become one with the vision. He's going to take it in. That means a clean vessel, the vessel. So then we have to give a lesser light. In order to have a vessel that really takes it in, the lesser light. A lesser light, the back of Hashem, can go into a vessel. So Moshe is seeing in a very clean vessel. Yeshaya is looking at a much higher place, but for that he won't be able to have a clean. It's always going to be more distant than him. Not really going to take it in. So Moshe became far more one with his prophecy than Isaiah did. Although Isaiah peaked into a higher place. Because Isaiah was meant to look from afar. Moshe was meant to look from up close. It's the same idea. Talmud is trying to look at much higher, so it has to stand farther away. Mishnah is looking... Mishnah is looking at a lower level of the divine, and therefore it can stand closer and receive it much more. A clean glass, and a non-clean glass. A higher level cannot reveal itself through a clean glass. Only if you're looking through a a frosty glass or something like that. Isaiah says, I've seen God. Moses says, that God, by Moshe, it says that no one can see him. So Yeshaya looked through a non-clean glass, that's called darkness. Legaba oir, compared to the light, the splakarya hamira, which is through a clean glass. Well, derech ze'inyananal, the same as the concept that we said earlier, the yoitzer oiru b'rechoshech, that he forms light and he creates darkness. Why by yetzira, the lefisha b'yetzira, ein me'erak vav k'tzav is datzilus, since the world of yetzira is in it is only shining the divine emotions. That's why over here the revelation can be very clear. You can have a clean glass. That's why it's called light. The vessel is fully illuminated. But the wisdom of God, the intelligence of Atzilus, of the world of emanation, which means God's intelligence, which about it says how deep are your thoughts. They're very deep. Hanistarois, they are the hidden element of God. We know that Yutke Vavke, the first two letters, the Yutke, are considered the concealed level. Since it's so concealed, you can't look at it up and close. It's impossible for it to reveal itself in the three lower worlds. Al derech pchinas or mamish, in a way of literal light. Okay, nemaru boirei choshech, and that's why it says he creates darkness. Shebebria, shesham nimshach mechabada atzilus. That in bria, which bria is higher than yetzira, which it is attempting to draw down the chabad of atzilus, the intelligence. It's gonna have to suffice by looking from a distant or looking from a non clear glass. Or remaining partially dark. It's by way of analogy, a non-clean glass, or through a darkness and more concealment. Now, just like we say that the laws of the Talmud are called olamos, because olamos means concealment, that there is a certain concealment because it's going so high, that very high level they can only sense it, but not really fully integrate it. That's why it's called concealment. That's also the reason why they're called young women and not wives. It doesn't mean that that the king is not shining in them. He's shining in them, but they're not taking it in. Lashon Alma, which means a maiden, Shupsula, which is a girl. A virgin, the ishla yada, that a man has not known her. Ma'achar, what does that mean? Shetipas hachachma ein. It says by Rivka, it says that Rivka was a virgin and a man had not known her. And by Rivka, it says she goes down to the well to draw the water, which we know that when Rivka was filling that cup of water, she was drawing the Torah from its source. But it says about her that a man did not know her. So what does that mean? Gevaldik. Man, a human being has a name, Adam, Ish, Enosh, and Gever. There are four names for a human. Ish is the, Adam is the intellectual element of the human. Ish is from the word ish. That's where the emotions are. So ish is God when he's manifesting in his emotions. He's called ish. So here's the idea: the reason why the Gemara, the Talmud, is called a virgin is because she's not trying to encounter God when God is in the level of ish. If she would be trying to encounter God when God is on a level of ish, brought himself down just to his emotions, if she wants to just get to know God's emotions, she wouldn't have to stay a virgin. She would be able to take it in and become married to him. But because she wants to transcend the level of ish, she wants to hit him, she wants to connect to him on the level of Adam. She wants to get to know his mind, not his ish element. That's the meaning of his ish lo yada'a. The level of ish was not intimate with her, was not because she wants to go higher than ish. Well, on that level, you can't achieve full intimacy. So you can be invited to the party, you can hang out, but you can't connect on that deep oneness. So ma'achar, that's since shetipas ha'chachma. What did we say earlier? The Orein Sof, the infinite light manifests in chachma, and chachma then later opens itself up into the bina and into the das, which creates the chabad of Hashem, and then further down into the emotions. So that's referred to. In the concept of an intimacy, because when there's an intimacy, a physical intimacy, the transmission from the man to the woman is from the chachma. You're drawing the seminal drop is taken from the chachma. It's taken from the highest part of the soul, from the chachma of the soul, and it's being drawn out. So, in Torah, there is the seminal drop of the divine. However, if the recipient is trying to receive that drop, once it's already manifested in the emotions, then it could be transferred completely in a way where the recipient, the vessel, can become, if you say, impregnated by it, can fully take it in. She can conceive. She can fully have it. She, as we said before, she can be the queen. But if she's trying to meet that droplet of chachma, when it's still on a very high level, before it descended down lower, when it's still, she wants to meet and become one with him on the level of intelligence, God's intelligence will always be infinitely beyond ours. And we can't merge on that level, fully. And that's why she remains a virgin. Now she's happy being there because she's happy going to a higher place. But on the other hand, she's forfeiting the idea of becoming really one with it. Since the droplet of chachma is not fully revealing itself in her, now, but it doesn't mean that there's no light. When we say darkness over here, we don't mean complete darkness, complete concealment. What are you getting? The point over here is there is revelation, but it's a vague revelation. It's like when we study these very high mystical concepts. Anybody that's listening, still on this class, listening right now, I hope you're getting something. You might not be getting everything, and I don't get anything at all over here. You feel, when you're learning this, you feel that this is like, whew, really, really high up there. But you're still getting, as opposed to not learning when you're not seeing any of this. You're seeing tremendous, it's a little bit at a distance. There's a revelation there. But it's not thorough. It's called, he creates darkness. In the world of Bria, of course, there's a lot of illumination. The way the light is revealing itself is it's like when a person has vision in the dark. When the lights are open, I can see clearly. I can see clearly what I'm looking at. I can see your face, I can see your features, I can see the colors of your skin. I can see a person. But when I'm looking at in the dark, so I can see, like you can see someone is there, but you don't know who it is. You can't see their face. You can't make out the details. That's the darkness. It's a vision in the dark. It's not. It's no vision. It's a vision in the darkness. I don't understand. The word Shem is batal mahusai. It's a little hard word over here. I think it would mean that the thing you're looking at is nullified its essence, which means its substance of what it is lost to you. You can't see that. Ve'ein roya shum davar heitiv, or it's referring to the person himself. When you're in the dark, you're it's a hard, I'm having a hard time with this word. You don't see anything clearly. When you see something, You don't see it thoroughly, va'al machainai, and on its full base. And therefore, ve'ein makifes adavar sharaya, ve'ein eri'ir shalai. You can't encompass it with your eyes. You can't surround it, although your eyes are touching it, meaning your vision is touching it, but it's not getting a clear, a real surrounding and complete encompassing. You're not taking it with your eyes, if you're taking it in. And that's the reason why, again, the laws of the Talmud are called these virgin girls that are connected to the king. They're getting of his awe, they're getting of his light, but they're not internalizing it. Zehu, and based on this, we'll understand a verse in Psalms. And I would, if possible, to get an English Tehillim, an English Psalms, because I forgot to. I looked this up last week when I was preparing the class, and this week I forgot to do it. Thank you. So in chapter 45 in Tehillim, in Psalms. Speaks about the psalmist composed this psalm referring to the Mashiach. He describes his greatness, his attributes, his glory, his wealth, and his reign, and states that Israel anticipates him, remembering and saying in every generation, when will King Mashiach come? It's a very beautiful chapter. It talks all about the king. And then it talks about his relationship with his subjects. And it says in verse number 15, talks about his queen. The queen and the princess. Now let's read like this. Let's start from chapter 7. Not chapter 7, verse 7. Your throne, O ruler, is forever and ever. Referring to Mashiach. For the scepter of justice is the scepter of your kingdom. You love righteousness and hate wickedness. Therefore has God, your God, anointed you with oil and joy above your peers. Explaining why God will give everything to Mashiach. Hashem will give everything to Mashiach. Because he loves justice and he hates wickedness. And then what is given to him? Myrrh, aloes, and cassia are the fragrance of all your garments, which are from ivory palaces that bring you joy. So his garments are from these, coming from ivory palaces that bring joy, whatever this, obviously this has deep mystical meaning. Then it says, daughters of kings visit you, and the queen stands erect at your right hand, adorned in the fine gold of Ophir. Okay, then he continues, hear, O daughter, and observe, incline your ear, forget your people and your father's house. It's referring to the everybody who wants to have a relationship with the king. So you're saying, listen here, the king, forget your people, forget your father's house. You have to be willing to like let go of everything to follow the king. Basically, you want to be a chassid of the Rebbe, that's to give yourself over completely. When we're talking about this king, requires a complete... Forget your father's house. Forget your connection to the material gashmiistic world. Give yourself over the shlichas. Give yourself over, because we're talking about being in a relationship with this king. The daughters over here is referring to all the people that want to connect to him on a deep inner level. And then it says, then the king will desire your beauty. He is your master. Bow to him. Then it says, Ubas Tsoir, the daughter of Tyre. which is the wealthiest of nations, will seek your favor with a gift. And here we're getting close to the verse that I wanted to read. All the glory of the princess is within. Her clothing surpasses settings of gold. Okay. And finally, in embroidered garments, she will be brought to the king. The maidens in her train, her companions, will be led to you. So what does this mean again? Lidikamais, in embroidered garments, she will be brought to the king. So I guess this is... those women that will, or those, the princesses that will marry the king. The maidens in her train, I mean, she's not coming alone, she's coming with the maidens following her. Her companions will be led to you. So, what is the, this is the verse. So the Alter Rebbe is explaining it as follows. These maidens that go along with the princess, when she goes to the king in train, they all go along. What does this mean? The queen or the princess, that's the Shekhinah, that's Malchus itself. Malchus, the Shekhinah, is the recipient. Malchus is the inner core of all of creation. She's the soul of creation, the godly essence of all of creation. She's the recipient of this masculine light that we've been speaking about, this chachma and this emotions. He's going to share, he's going to transmit to her. So there is the Shekhinah itself, which is the Malchus itself, and then there is her maidens. What are the maidens? The maidens are, I'm going to hold it. Now we know that the Shekhinah is the Torah Shebaal Peh, the oral law, is called is Malchus. The general element of the entire oral law, that's Malchus. The detailed individual laws of the Talmud, as we spoke earlier, are the maidens that go along with the... Now, they themselves can't go to the king, but when she goes, they are all elevated up along with her. Which means, it seems like, the concept over here is that although... when we're trying to attempt through the sages of the Talmud to really assimilate the light and to have a complete integration and a complete illumination, so regularly it's not possible. But it looks like when there's a certain inward tide, suction, and the entire cosmic order rises upward and the Shekhinah rises upward, along with it comes these chambers that are generally too constricted for them to be able to receive the light, the pure divinity, to fully merge with them. But it seems like once the queen is going, they're going along. In the sense, they're going along into that union with the king. So what that would seem like is that, and again, that the words I don't see, I haven't seen these literal words in the Maamar, but it would seem like that even the maidens of the Talmud, the halachis of the Talmud, that are not privied for a complete unification, but they are elevated, but not based on their own right, based on their own merit. They're elevated when there is a elevation of Torah Shebaal Peh in general. The Torah Shebaal Peh, the oral law and the written law, our husband and life, our wife. The written law is HaKadosh Baruch Hu, is the masculine, and the Shekhinah is the feminine. The Shekhinah is what receives it all and translates it into creation language. The Ze'er Anpin is all divine. It's all infinite. And the Shekhinah, so there is the general Shekhinah, and then there are the details of it. The chambers. The chambers can't unify with the light, but when she goes, they will go drafted along with her. So there is an aliyah to the elements of Talmud that they do they are filled. It's almost like, you know, little holes by the beach, crevices or little dugouts that most of the time are dry and they're not filled with the water. They sit there. But when there's a high tide that comes in, suddenly they're all filled. Right? So it would seem like something like that. There is moments when because the Shekhinah, let's read it inside. What does that mean? With embroidered garments, Tuvala Melech, she will be brought to the king. Besulois achareha, the young maidens are following her behind her. Re'asah, her friends. Ki. In these laws that they are called alamois because they don't have that union. Shem shiva hechalois de bria. They are the seven chambers of the world of bria. That means even though we said before that how many girls are there is no number. That's if you're going into detail. But in general, there are seven chambers in the world of Bria. Since they are the chambers of the world of Bria, Bria is already creation. They're not privy to what? To the light of Atzilus. And since in Bria, what's supposed to descend into Bria is the light of Chabad, of God's mind, and that is too high for it to come into a finite vessel. So even though the light is there, as we said earlier, it's there and not there. It's connected, but not fully connected. So Nikroim Besulois, they are called Besulois. You know where we have these seven maidens? These seven girls? We have them by Esther. Because Esther is the Shekhinah. Esther, Queen Esther, we're going to learn about by Purim, by coming up to Purim. And it says that when she went to see Achashverosh, they gave her along seven maidens. The Sheva Na'arais, these are these seven maidens. Because Esther is a metaphor for the Shekhinah when she goes down into the world of Bria. So she has seven maidens. These are the seven Hechalois, the seven chambers of the world of Bria that are kind of her family. And Shaloi Kibla Arabetoich over there, and they can't receive the radiance inside of them. Bizgalos. In a revealed way, only when they're in a way of like being, as we said before, they become batal, which means they don't have the ability to take it in. A little bit of shining, but it's an external type of a shining. It's not able to reveal itself fully into the vessel, which is limited. That's why they become kind of nullified. Because when you try to understand something and you don't really understand it, it nullifies you. Maybe that's what he means earlier when he says that you become nullified in the dark. Because you can't see, it kind of knocks you out. That's why it calls behind her. When Malchus is elevated, and Malchus itself is being brought to the king, then they're elevated. Gam Zayin Haycholos Hanal. Those seven chambers are also elevated. There are times that the Talmud is also elevated. When the Baal Shem Tov goes in to receive pure Ein Sof light, then the entire Gemara gets elevated along with it. The Gemara, the Shas, Bavli, goes along with the Baal Shem Tov. That's the concept we're really learning over here. When those that are able to have the deepest bittul, the highest tzaddikim, the Shekhinah themselves are going in, then even the more external chambers come along. Mavos lach, they're brought to you. And the words are, it doesn't say they go to you, it says they are muvos, they are brought. Because they can't do it themselves. It's like they suddenly get suctioned in by the powerful suction that brings the Shekhinah in. The pull pulls them along. It's not like there's any power in their own understanding to be able to open up, to be able to receive it. But it's a moment. Memela, kilo kiblu ashpa toich toicham. They have not received it. The ain meir babi is galus b'toicha keli. It's not shining in the vessel. Ain akle the yochel hagbalar. The keli is not able to take it. Ach machmas is galus. because there's such a high revelation sheyesh that there is there mevuas lach memela, they're brought in automatically. Again, how this translates into it's very vague words, this part of the Mayimer, very vague words. So it's hard to really crack what he means over here. And it fits that we shouldn't understand this because this is exactly what we're talking about the part that we're not on. So I can see the Alter Rebbe spinning, throwing out a piece over here, which is meant for us to be like, huh? Because that's what he's exactly explaining, the concept of how they are. But what does this mean? Mavos lach memel. Okay. I was planning to finish the Maimer today, but I'm not going to do that. Because I'm not going to do justice to the next piece. And because this was so much to digest in this one piece over here. So we're going to leave the last piece for next week, which is going to explain how, in order to accomplish any of this, we first need serious prayer. Because to activate it all, just learning itself does not. With learning itself, you have the vessels, but you don't have the light shining in the vessels. To have the light shining in the vessels, you first need powerful meditative prayer, which activates everything. And then when you study and you learn, you can have the flow of God flowing through your mouth, flowing in the Mishnah, flowing in the Talmud, flowing in the Braisa on the various different levels that we've discussed over here, flowing into the queen's concubines, and even to a certain degree, as we said before, these girls. Okay. We shall stop over here and continue Be'ezrat Hashem next week, Thursday, with the last piece.